Blog Talk Radio.
Not my country. My country is me and my family.
Your country's also Huerta. And the governor, the landlords, Gunther Ruiz and his locusts. This little revolution we're having here.
Revolution? Revolution, please don't try to tell me about revolution. I know all about the revolutions and how they start. The people that read the books, they go to the people that don't read the books. They put people and say, ho, ho, the time has come to have a change, eh? Shit, shush! I know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the revolutions.
The people who read the books, or the people who can't read the books, the poor people and say, we have to have a change, so the poor people make the change, huh?
And then the people who read the books, they all sit around the big polished tables and they talk and talk and talk and eat and eat and eat. Huh? But what has happened to the poor people? They're dead! That's your revolution.
So please, don't tell me about revolutions.
Appeared before the Congressional Committee to tell what I knew of activities which might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship.
The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
The very word secrecy is repugnant.
So, what are we claiming here today? To put it in a nutshell, namely, that Republic for the United States of America is the lawful civil authority upon the land. And we've claimed that for some time now, but we have even more standing than we had before. We've gone through an electoral college process. Back in the October-November time frame, I challenged the several states. In other words, I handed the football off to the states to go through the electoral college process, that they would choose electors. Those electors would come together and follow the law. And that's exactly what has happened. So it's been an arm's length process for me as the acting president that I was able to step away from that. The executive branch did put publication in a national newspaper about the election, giving public notice. But I'm pleased to tell you today that the states did follow through, the several states did follow through. They did their job as prescribed by law, followed the electoral college process. And so I'm standing here before you today, no longer as acting president, but as president for the Republic for the United States of America. So that should go a long way towards explaining why some people might say, well, I'm a self-appointed president. Well, that's absolutely not true. And the...
1, 2, 3, 4.
Yes, I need it. Sometimes I get away. Get out of my way. No need to find another. You don't change the day. I don't need no bracelet. Glancing from my back. Thank you. Thank you for the good night.
Thank you.
what you have, what you have, what you have, what you have, what you have.
These people's organization helped the Contras smuggle tons of cocaine and laundered drug profits through Arkansas. Why did the Reagan Justice Department fail to prosecute? Did Bill Clinton, then the governor, fail to provide leadership and support for a successful state prosecution? The White House says he did all he could. But Agent Duncan, Cooper Welts, Prosecutor Black, and a lot of other people are still looking for answers. In Washington, this is Bill Plath for Eye on America.
Why the Antifa grand jury was not successful in bringing forth indictments, and why the media was unsuccessful in detailing the inner workings of the CIA's operations, requires the insight and comments of Terry Reid. Now, come meet a spy, a man who lived this sordid story alongside Barry Seal, a man who has now severed his relationship with the intelligence community in order to expose this cover-up.
Hello there, I'm Terry Reid. Let me tell you a little about myself. I'm a family man, businessman, and Vietnam veteran whose life got a little off course as the result of the so-called Iran-Contra affair. But just to set the record straight, I'm not a drug trafficker, and I've never knowingly associated with anyone who is. I was, however, recruited and freely enlisted in the so-called enterprise for the purpose of assisting the Contras. I did so purely for patriotic reasons, although others I worked with obviously had selfish agendas. Be that as it may, I have no regrets in helping to rid Nicaragua of the communist-backed Sandinista regime. I would do it all again. I'm participating in the production of this documentary to show you that the real Nicaraguan guerrilla support effort took place in Arkansas through a very sophisticated CIA network set in place by the Reagan White House and monitored by Bill Clinton's gubernatorial administration. I know this because I was part of that support effort. In fact, after viewing this documentary, I'm confident you will conclude that through the efforts of Ronald Reagan's Attorney General Edwin Meese, phase one of the deceit began. Let me explain. By Meese divulging the unauthorized weapons shipments to our enemy Iran, and accusing a lowly Marine Lieutenant Colonel of seizing the reins of foreign policy. Well, that act in itself was a clever diversion. The media went for the bait and immediately labeled the entire fiasco the Iran-Contra affair. But instead of scurrying east out of Washington and focusing their investigative efforts on the Middle East, the hostage crisis, and the diversion of weapons sales profits to the Contras, reporters should have gone west to Arkansas. But why should you believe me? Let me tell you a little about my life within the intelligence community and how a starry-eyed and patriotic young man from Missouri got swept into a world of espionage, secret foreign policy, deniable operations, and deceit. To begin with, Harry S. Truman was and still is my personal hero. I had the very good fortune of meeting Mr. Truman when I was 17 years old, and that occasion left a lasting imprint in my mind. You know, Missouri politics, religion, duty, honor, and commitment to family and community greatly influenced my upbringing. As the eldest of six children, I can most assuredly say that my father, himself a veteran of World War II, raised me and my three brothers with a clear understanding that we owed a debt to our country, that we had to repay our nation for the privilege of living in freedom. And being raised in Carthage, Missouri, a town of 10,000, a true Norman Rockwell setting, only 21 miles from the birthplace of President Truman, instilled in me a set of rural Midwestern values that I cherish and protect to this day. When my country called during the Vietnam War, I responded. I felt it was time to apply the military skills taught me from 4 years of Army ROTC training. After all, It was Harry Truman who had commissioned the ROTC program in Carthage that I had been fortunate enough to serve as a cadet company commander. After taking the military oath at the induction center in Kansas City, Missouri, our government placed me in Air Force Intelligence. Upon graduation from a whole series of intelligence curriculums, I was then handpicked to serve in Defense Secretary Robert S. McNamara's ultra-top secret unit designated Task Force Alpha, based in the remote northeast jungles of Thailand. From there, the U.S. Air Force orchestrated a secret air and ground war in Laos and Cambodia. Our mission was to be the deniable link between authorized military operations and the unauthorized activities of the Central Intelligence Agency. We assigned Air America the tasks that were just quite frankly too unthinkable for the U.S. military to conduct. Now, this was my introduction to black or deniable activities. In the course of serving 8 years within the Air Force's intelligence community and pulling 2.5 years of duty in Southeast Asia, I met and worked with some of the people who would later surface in the so-called Iran-Contra affair. In fact, it was in Southeast Asia that I met and worked with a man named William Cooper, the Air America pilot who died in the crash of an American cargo plane that was shot down in Nicaragua, October 5th of 1986, the crash that exposed the CIA's efforts to violate the so-called Bolin Amendments, you know, the laws Congress passed to limit the American assistance to the Contras. But after becoming disillusioned with the peacetime military, I elected to be separated from the military in 1976. I then enrolled in a pilot training curriculum in Southwest Missouri and graduated 3 years later with nearly every available aviation license and rating known. Then by sheer coincidence, I entered an industry laden with agents of the KGB and those of our so-called ally Japan, who were actually attempting to steal American defense technology. So it was in Oklahoma City in 1980, while working as executive vice president of a high-technology trading company, that I was recruited by the FBI's counterintelligence division to monitor and help disrupt the efforts of agents of the Kremlin who had penetrated the American machine tool industry. These activities and adventures, I might add, required me to travel behind the Iron Curtain, not only to sow some seeds of deceit, but to pirate some Soviet technology as well. But where I feel this story gets interesting is later while working under deep cover on the now famous Toshiba case, the one involving the theft and sale of American nuclear submarine technology to the KGB by Japan's Toshiba Machine Tool Company. It was then that I was put into play with an agent of the CIA who carried the code name of John Caffey. Now, there's a place in Oklahoma City in early 1982, and Agent John Caffey's real name is Oliver Lawrence North, the same Marine Lieutenant Colonel later accused of taking over the Department of State by Ronald Reagan's administration. As North and I worked together, we shared memories of not only our combat experiences in Southeast Asia, but rehashed our mutual disdain for Congress as well, the same Congress that had put us as young soldiers in harm's way and then sat back and debated the morality of it all. The North also shared with me what he referred to as a secret Reagan plan to destroy the USSR. He continuously referred to Russia in our conversations as a failed colonial power, that the timing was right to incite revolution within the Russian colonies. It was through these efforts, North confided, that the CIA felt Russia collapse economically. Then North asked if I was interested in helping to deal what he called a death blow to the evil empire that it kept its finger on the nuclear trigger throughout my lifetime. I can say this, I enthusiastically jumped on board what is now referred to as the secret Reagan agenda. It was then, through my rather intimate relationship with North, that I was quietly tapped to support the Contra effort. North arranged for me to be introduced to a man named Admiral Barryman Seale. Barry Seale was an asset of the CIA, and the man tasked with setting up the necessary facilities to keep the Contras alive in body and soul, as Ronald Reagan had instructed Oliver North. Now that brings this story to Mena, Arkansas, because it was in Mena that Barry Seale had set up operations to covertly support and modify aircraft belonging to various federal agencies. Hey, but enough about my background. Besides, I'm getting bored just sitting here talking. You know, Barry Seal referred to me, as he did to himself, as a calculated risk taker. And I suppose that sums up the nature of most pilots. I've also been accused of being a rather action-oriented individual. So I've got an idea. Let's leave this stuffy office and head on out to the airport. You know, airplanes play a major role in this story. In fact, airplanes lead the so-called trail of truth that will follow as we lay open the MENA connection for public inspection. As you can see, I'm now dressed more appropriate to the role of a flight instructor. This is the way I dressed as I trained the Nicaraguan pilots in near MENA, Arkansas. We're also filming now in the Mall Aircraft Factory in Georgia for a reason. That reason being the Mall aircraft such as this one, came to bear heavy in the Iran-Contra story. As Richard Secord, Oliver North, and the CIA went shopping for small aircraft to use in Nicaragua in a hostile, very hostile combat environment, they came to the Mall Aircraft Company because Mall had a proven track record and built a very unique aircraft, an aircraft very suited to be used in rough terrain, unimproved conditions, primarily because of the what is referred to as a conventional landing gear configuration using a tail wheel in lieu of a nose wheel. The Mall aircraft, in addition to being a high-performance STOL, or short takeoff and landing airplane, afforded the capability of delivering the necessary supplies and munitions to the guerrilla war action in Nicaragua as the Contras fought the Sandinista soldiers. My role in all of this, of course, was to use my flight instructor credentials and expertise, pass along my mission skills to approximately 24 Nicaraguan nationals so that they could, in fact, liberate their own country, so that they could go back and replace the CIA's efforts to the Contras alive, body and soul, as Ronald Reagan said, to keep the Contras in the field, supplied with munitions, regardless of what Congress, the American Congress, said. I'm not here to debate the rightness or wrongness of our efforts. In this documentary, I simply want to convince you, the viewer, that this went on and that this aircraft had a very instrumental role in all of that. In my book, Compromised, Clinton, Bush, and the CIA, I refer to a time in 1984 in which a friend of mine, William Cooper, a pilot that I'd known from Thailand, an Air America pilot, flew an aircraft very similar to this aircraft into the North Little Rock Airport. He was flying that day with another Arkansan pilot, a man named Buzz Sawyer. Buzz Sawyer was from Magnolia, Arkansas, and Buzz had a distinguished career in aviation. His roots also went back to that of Air America, Thailand, the CIA, the place where a lot of us young, patriotic people from the Midwest cut our teeth in these deep, dark secrets that are still secrets for the most part of what actually went on in Southeast Asia. Little did I know that was the last time I would see Buzz Sawyer. In fact, it was Bill Cooper at the controls of the C-123K, the Fat Lady, that was shot down in Nicaragua October 5th, 1986, thus exposing the whole Iran-Contra affair. In the right seat in that C-123K, the Fat Lady, was Mr. Sawyer as well. I lost two friends that day. I tell you this story now because I think it's important for the American people to understand what we did in and around MENA, Arkansas, and why I chose to cross that line and get involved in a very deep black operation in and around MENA, an operation that neither the Democratic Party nor the Republicans want to accept ever happened.
So the Democrats and Republicans don't want to accept the MENA operation ever happened, huh? That's the problem. A lot of important people who have a lot to lose would like to convince you that MENA never happened. But it did happen. And one very large, undeniable piece of evidence Nino was CIA back is the airplane the government provided Barry Seal so he could fly tons of munitions from Arkansas to Central America. That airplane, the Fairchild C-123, nicknamed the Fat Lady, connects dots between the CIA's Air America and Southeast Asia. Mena, Arkansas, the CIA's proprietary airline in Miami, Florida, named Southern Air Transport, and the Iran-Contra affair, the so-called hostile shootdown. That was the day Barry Seal's Fat Lady crashed in Nicaragua, and the Reagan-Bush administration could no longer deny they were bypassing the law of Congress and the will of the American people. Let's go back to the airport. Terry would like to show you an airplane similar to an old friend of his. He called her the Fat Lady. It's time for her to sing. And what a story she has to tell. The real story of Iran-Contra. The one more appropriately entitled Iran-Contra Affair Through the So-Called Hassanfuss Shootdown. That was the day Barry Seal's Fat Lady crashed in Nicaragua, and the Reagan-Bush administration could no longer deny they were bypassing the law of Congress and the will of the American people. Let's go back to the airport. Terry would like to show you an airplane similar to an old friend of his. He called her the Fat Lady, and it's time for her to sing. And what a story she has to tell. The real story of Iran-Contra. The one more appropriately entitled The MENA Connection.
Barry Seal was provided a provider, very appropriately, a C-123K that had been stored in an Air Force museum at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio. That aircraft, the C-123K that Barry Seal affectionately nicknamed the Fat Lady, becomes the common thread that sews together several black operations in a fairly dark period of American history in the mid-1980s. You see, I was at Mena, Arkansas, the day Barry Seal first flew in his C-123K, the Fat Lady. The C-123K was a very instrumental aircraft in that it had the payload capability to fly munitions from Arkansas to staging areas in Central America, primarily Honduras and El Salvador. The interesting part of the story is these were weapons that were drawn from National Guard armories in Arkansas at a time in which Bill Clinton was commander-in-chief of the Arkansas National Guard. Some of these weapons were then mated with secret component parts that were being built by CIA contractors in Arkansas, component parts that would in effect, bear no serial numbers, component parts that would become untraceable. Little did we all know that a C-123K, such as this one, would be shot down by a Soviet SA-7 handheld missile on October the 5th, 1986, and thereby shed a lot of unwanted light on a very secret operation, a secret operation backed by the CIA to bypass the will of Congress and supply the Contras in their effort to defeat the Sandinista regime.
As you can probably tell, Terry Reed loves airplanes, and flying is one of his passions. His ability to transfer his flying skills to others is why Barry Seal and the CIA hired him. But Terry's story is much larger than just that of a flight instructor. He joined Oliver North's MENA operation with bona fide intelligence credentials provided by the United States Air Force. For this reason, Terry was entrusted to orbit with some pretty heavy hitters coming from both sides of the equation, both government and civilian. Let's catch up with Terry and see if he will tell us the names of some of these heavy hitters in the MENA story. Terry, in your book, Compromised, you talk about being sponsored into Bill Clinton's inner circle shortly after moving to Little Rock in 1983.
That's right. You know, my background's manufacturing. And I'd moved to Arkansas and co-founded a business, an ultralight manufacturing firm, with a man named Seth Ward. Now, Seth refers to himself as a Little Rock industrialist. He is, in fact, a self-made multimillionaire. And Seth is now emerging, though, as sort of the mystery man behind the whole Whitewater affair. Seth has a son-in-law named Webb Hubble. Webb Hubble, of course, worked at the Rose Law Firm and, in fact, right adjacent to Hillary Clinton's office. So, in fact, it was through Seth Ward and Webb Hubble that my wife Janice and I were introduced into the social circles of Little Rock, Arkansas.
Now, is that the same Seth Ward whose name has been associated with Madison Guaranty, the Little Rock savings and loan controlled at one time by James McDougal, the so-called friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton who brought them into the Whitewater Land Development Project?
Yeah, that is the same Seth Ward, all right. And, of course, his son-in-law, Webb Hubble, is the man who worked side-by-side with Hillary Clinton at the Rose Law Firm and the man who Clinton had as his number three person in the Department of Justice until Webb resigned. The same Webb Hubble who is now a felon as a result of pleading guilty to Whitewater-related crimes. I believe they included overbilling the government when Webb was at the Rose Law Firm and tax invasion. It looks like Webb Hubble will soon be a star prosecution witness in the Whitewater investigation.
Terry, it seems the Ward family was right in the thick of things. Were there any other family members that play into the story?
Yeah, the Ward family is actually sort of infamous in Arkansas. Seth has a one son. His name is Seth Jr. People call him Skeeter. Skeeter manages the family-owned business POM, or Park on Meter, in Russellville, Arkansas. And, of course, the world now knows that POM has a military division that has provided weapons parts for various concerns, including Ivers Johnson Firearms, the CIA's proprietary. You know, Skeeter even admitted this clandestine relationship in a secretly taped interview.
Ran my machines so I can shift and I get the parts out for them real quick, and I never stiffed me. I never paid it for bankrupt.
But you did make some parts for Ivers Johnson.
I made some firing pins, I think it was, on a screw machine. Then it's about $12,000 worth, and I never paid it for bankrupt.
But an often overlooked ex-member of the Ward clan is Finest Shellnut. Finest surfaced briefly when the Jennifer Flowers scandal broke. Papers. But when I met Finest in 1983, he was married to Seth Ward's youngest daughter, and it was Finest who worked for a bond trader named Dan Lassiter.
Dan Lassiter? That's the name I've heard before. Isn't he Bill Clinton's old friend, and wasn't he convicted of cocaine charges?
Yeah, that's right. Dan Lassiter is another multimillionaire that enters into this story. Dan, of course, was a very high-profile bond trader who lived in Little Rock in the mid-1980s, traveled in very high social circles. In fact, it was Dan Lassiter who not only employed Finest Shellnut, but it was Dan Lassiter who employed Roger Clinton as well.
Dan Lassiter employed Roger Clinton, the president's brother? Didn't they both go to prison on cocaine charges?
Yeah, that's right. You know, it was Roger who was Dan's chauffeur, actually. And, of course, it was Dan Lassiter and Roger who got involved in the whole drug investigation that ultimately ended up ensnaring about 10 other prominent Arkansans, including an Arkansas state senator. So there was a multitude of people that went to prison over this story. Another interesting point, though, that I point out in my book, Lassiter and Company, Dan Lassiter's firm, is where Barry Seal was doing not only his, but the CIA's investment banking.
You're saying, as an insider, that you have knowledge of Barry Seal running the CIA's money through Lassiter and into the Arkansas bond business.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You know, in fact, Barry Seal confided to me that he was taking millions of dollars of money to Dan Lassiter to more or less be laundered through his firm in the form of loans, money being slipped back quietly to CIA subcontractors, companies performing services for the CIA in Arkansas during this whole time frame.
That sounds like a pretty slick arrangement, but it must have included people beyond Seal and Lassiter to pull that off without triggering questions from bank officials. Can you name any of the recipients of these fictitious loans?
Yes, I can. In my book, in fact, I document a $2.75 million loan made to POM or Park on Meter. Now, that money was diverted through ADFA, Arkansas Development and Finance Authority, which in itself was a quasi-state-run organization set up by Bill Clinton for the purpose of administering loans to underprivileged companies.
Terry, are you saying that ADFA, the Arkansas Development Finance Authority, a state agency, was created by Bill Clinton as a way to launder CIA money?
I can say this. From its inception in 1985 to 1991, ADFA loaned out over $719 million. Now, there have been Freedom of Information lawsuits filed in Arkansas trying to get the state to show the buyers of those bonds, the bond sales that went to create that kind of money. To date, there's been no admission by the state of where that money came from. And the POM loan, going back to it, was in violation of ADFA's charter, because certainly POM would have qualified for outside loans without ADFA's backing.
That is a lot of money. Nearly $750 million. And you say Barry Seal's organization was responsible for bringing in a substantial amount of that cash.
Well, by Seal's own estimate, he was flying in nearly $40 million a month into Little Rock at the height of the money laundering activities in 1985.
Tell me, has anyone else surfaced who could help corroborate the strange goings-on within the bond industry of Arkansas?
Yes, there's a man named Dennis Patrick and others who have surfaced, but Patrick can document over $109 million was laundered through his bond trading account in the mid-1980s.
Where was Patrick doing his trading?
At Dan Lassiter's. At the same time frame, Barry Seal was flying in the agency's money.
$109 million. No wonder they call Arkansas the land of opportunity. But tell me, when was the MENA operation, as you knew it, when was it curtailed, and why did the CIA shut it down?
Since you brought up their old state slogan, to answer that, you really must go back to their other state slogan, which is Arkansas is a natural high. You see, it was the drug investigation into Dan Lassiter and Roger Clinton that caused the CIA to abruptly curtail their operation and pull out. What had transpired was by 1986, there were two independent grand juries being formed to really start probing into all this money laundering activity, which appeared to be coming from a major drug operation. The last thing the CIA needed was for a multitude of their assets to be dragged before federal grand juries.
Terry, I recall in your book you talking of a high-level secret meeting taking place near Little Rock in early 1986. It included discussions of neutralizing the Justice Department's probe into MENA and Dan Lassiter's firm. Tell us about that meeting. Who attended, and why was the meeting called?
The meeting you're referring to is the meeting I call the bunker meeting, since the meeting took place in a World War II ammunition storage bunker at Camp Robinson, an army camp slightly northwest of Little Rock. The meeting had been called actually as an operational transitional meeting to discuss the nuts and bolts of moving part of this operation to Mexico. But what transpired was a rather heated discussion between Bill Clinton and the CIA's designee from Washington concerning damage control for the Clinton gubernatorial administration.
Now, let me get this straight. You're saying you can place Bill Clinton directly in the Iran-Contra loop?
I certainly can. And, you know, I almost wish I couldn't, because I feel a lot of my legal problems stem from the fact that Clinton thrust himself into that meeting, but basically exposing himself to all of us that were attending, and thus, in essence, compromising himself.
Did he compromise him to?
Well, certainly me. You know, I was asked to come in to cover the loose technical ends of my transfer to Guadalajara. The man who I was scheduled to have a one-on-one discussion with was a man who I knew as Max Gomez, who was going to be my new handler in Mexico. Beyond that, John Cathy, my old CIA handler from Oklahoma City, was there. Aki Sawahata, who was the local CIA resident case officer in Little Rock, he attended the meeting. In addition to that, the person that was supposed to come in and represent the state's interests was a man named Bob Nash, who was the director of Arkansas Development and Finance Authority.
Terry, I read your book. Now, most of these people weren't really using their real names, were they? They had code names, right?
Well, you know, I would find years later that I was orbiting in some pretty high circles, very high echelons, that even to this day still impress me. Let's try to decode these guys. First of all, John Cathy is, in fact, Oliver North. Secondly, Max Gomez, now that's interesting. Gomez is, in fact, Felix Rodriguez. Rodriguez, not only being an ex-CIA agent going back to the Bay of Pigs, the Phoenix Project in Vietnam, Felix Rodriguez is a close confidant of George Bush's and the man who tracked down and was even around during the assassination of Che Guevara. Che Guevara being Fidel Castro's lieutenant. Beyond that, we had Aki Sawahata is still a mystery man to me. We still don't know his real identity. But a man named Robert Johnson is actually William P. Barr, who was later the attorney general for George Bush. Now, I believe I've named everyone, but there were two people that we think were still using their correct names, and that being Bob Nash and Bill Clinton.
Of course, we know now Bill Clinton's real name isn't Bill Clinton. Let's get back to the discussions of damage control.
Well, you've already witnessed the frustration of several police officers who just could not get the MENA story to go forward. Their investigations seemed to be contained or undermined, short-circuited, whatever you want to call them. In that bunker meeting, I witnessed the containment effort for this entire scandal, and quite frankly, it's shocking to realize all it took was for the authority of two U.S. attorneys to be undermined. The language that was used was that these guys would basically get religion. And if our system of checks and balances is that fragile, something's wrong. But obviously, that's what went on because the rest is history. There were no indictments handed up.
So two U.S. attorneys were somehow told just to back off? Is that right?
That's exactly what I'm saying. You know, so-called national security interest can undermine a whole Justice Department if a sitting attorney general does not the marching orders given him by the president and, in this case, the director of the CIA.
So how many times did you meet with Bill Clinton?
Actually, on three separate occasions. Only two of which I'm free to discuss on this interview. The third may come up in my court case in Little Rock, Arkansas. But you heard about the first one, the one in the so-called bunker meeting. The second one took place outside of a Mexican food restaurant in Little Rock named Juanita's. That brief encounter, impromptu encounter, was to discuss my moving on down to Mexico to help set up the CIA's front company at the Guadalajara Airport.
Terry, why did Clinton care if you moved to Mexico or not?
Yeah, that's a good question. And in hindsight, I'm sure Bill Clinton saw me as a liability. You know, considering what all I had seen while I worked there with the Central Intelligence Agency, considering the social circles I was orbiting in, well, I'm sure he was just as, quite frankly, wanted me as far from Little Rock, Arkansas as he could get me.
So in other words, he wanted you out of Dodge City, right?
Well, yeah, that's right. There were no threatening comments, but he made it very clear while sitting there in his van outside the restaurant that he wanted me to go ahead and continue with my plans to move to Mexico to fulfill my obligation with the CIA.
You moved to Mexico to set up this front company for the CIA. Sounds exciting.
Well, you know, quite frankly, it got a little more exciting than I had bargained for. My job was really just to move to the Guadalajara airport, set up a company, Machinery International, who was to be a bona fide company, a company to operate in the machine tool industry, a company to bring in equipment to help automate Mexico. Now, of course, covertly, it was to perform services for the U.S. government.
Just exactly what did these covert services include?
Phase one of the plan was pretty simple. This company was to store, warehouse, safeguard, transship weapons, weapons that were destined ultimately for Central America. Phase two of the plan, however, which I found much more interesting, was that Machinery International would serve as a controlling entity to actually manufacture weapons on Mexican soil.
Were the plans implemented?
Well, I moved my family to Mexico in July of 1986, but phase one of the plan was abruptly interrupted in October of that same year due to the C-123 shootdown. That incident caused us all to basically lie low for a while. However, by January of 1987, we all breathed a sigh of relief and decided to go forward with the plan, thinking that the Mexican side of the enterprise hadn't really been discovered. Phase two, just as we were starting into phase two, I was sort of taken out of the operation due to what I call as a rift with my CIA handlers.
Terry, tell us about that rift. In the book, you keep us on the edge of our seats while you negotiate your way out of Mexico. But this was a little more than a casual rift. This was life and death stuff.
Well, you know, my agreement with the CIA was to transship weapons, plain and simple. No one had ever discussed transshipment of drugs with me. If they had, I wouldn't have been involved in any of this. But by early 1987, I had proved to myself beyond the shadow of a doubt that some of the people I was working with were using my facility and using the aircraft that were hauling the weapons in order to transship cocaine back to the United States.
How much cocaine?
Literally tons. You know, we're not talking kilos here, but tons.
So there is no war on drugs?
Not from what I ever saw, at least not while operating out of Guadalajara. You know, my whole problem began when I took Nancy Reagan's advice and tried to say no to the drug trafficking side of this story.
Did you have any evidence of the CIA's drug trafficking through your facilities? Any witnesses?
Yes, in fact, there was a very credible witness, and I might add he's been thoroughly deposed about his observations of cocaine being transshipped through my Guadalajara warehouse.
In the book, you detailed a trip to San Miguel de Allende, a town in Mexico, where you confronted Felix Rodriguez, a.k.a. Max Gomez, with your evidence that his operation was in the drug business. Tell us about that meeting.
First of all, there's a witness to that meeting. I planned it that way. I took a Mexican citizen friend of mine, a man named Patrick Juin, to basically serve as my insurance policy. I strategically positioned Patrick in a restaurant so he could observe Max Gomez, a.k.a. Felix Rodriguez, and Rodriguez could observe him. You know, I kid you not, I was frightened. The good side is Patrick didn't have to witness a homicide, and of course, the bad side is things didn't turn out as we agreed in that meeting.
So you and Mr. Gomez came to an amicable agreement? He considered you a loose cannon, right? I mean, you wouldn't go along with the drug trafficking. You just waltzed out of there?
Well, that's what happened, although I did have a major bargaining chip. I was in possession of evidence that concretely proved that cocaine had been transshipped through my warehouse by CIA people.
What kind of concrete evidence?
Well, I had samples of shipment that I had found in my warehouse in Guadalajara, July 5th, 1987. You see, I had had the wherewithal to safeguard a few kilos just to be used as evidence, seeing as how my handlers kept complaining I lacked concrete evidence. But it was mutually agreed upon that I didn't have what it took to be a CIA agent, and I should probably leave Mexico. So eventually it was agreed upon that my wife and I and our three sons could travel back to the U.S. unharmed.
But you were double-crossed, weren't you? I mean, you do say in the book you found out you weren't dealing with honorable men.
Correct. And that's where this story gets real personal and real scary. Shortly after my family and I crossed the Rio Grande, we were able to ascertain that there had been a computer profile created on us that labeled us pretty much a modern-day Bonnie and Clyde. That profile showed us as being armed and dangerous. It said that we carried concealed weapons, had known to use them in the past. Of course, it labeled me as a high-profile drug trafficker operating out of Central and South America. And besides that, we found out that people were actively trying to determine our whereabouts.
What did you think they wanted?
Well, most assuredly, they wanted me to meet the same demise as Barry Seal. They wanted me and my wife dead.
Terry, did you ever find out who created the false computer profile of you and your wife?
And yes, that person is Bill Clinton's old chief of security, Arkansas State Police Captain Raymond Buddy Young. Now, Mr. Young is no longer with the Arkansas State Police, however. Mr. Young is now with FEMA, or Federal Emergency Management Authority, for the Southwest out of Denton, Texas.
But you and your wife have sued Buddy Young and the others who say you were involved in this ordeal, correct?
Yeah, the criminal justice system was obviously used against me and my wife by some very powerful, selfish, and cowardly individuals. We've sued the people that we feel we can prove helped orchestrate the wrongful criminal indictment against us. I'm not going to sleep until I can drag those people to court. They have to be held accountable for their actions. In fact, the federal judge who acquitted me said that Young and another ex-trooper had what he called demonstrated a reckless disregard for the truth. The Harry Truman, my old hero, wouldn't have been so kind with his selection of words. Harry would have said, they are blatant liars who perjure themselves as they try desperately to get me and my wife convicted on trumped-up felony charges, just to destroy my credibility. But I'm still willing to give the system its chance to work and drag those who attempt to destroy me to justice.
Terry, do you feel threatened? I mean, you're obviously making some very powerful people very, very nervous.
Sure, I'm human, and I operate under a continuous threat of not only to my person, but my family as well. You know, our phones have been bugged. We've had burglaries. I've had a written death threat pasted on top of a cover page of Time magazine. These are cowardly people who it's difficult to tell what they'd resort to once we get them fully cornered. But I can tell you this. I know what they're most frightened of, and it's a court of law.
Come now and meet the woman, Janice Reed, who was needlessly and mercilessly targeted and pursued by government agents. Meet Terry Reed's wife, the woman who has stood steadfast by his side during this strenuous ordeal. Janice, tell us, what is it like to marry a spy, to live a double life as the wife of a spy?
It's an interesting situation in that we were dealing with the FBI, the CIA, and the KGB, and it was hard to tell who was whom.
When you and Terry decided to get married, who did he tell you he was spying for?
It was with the FBI in a relationship with the CIA.
Did you meet some of the other agents and spies Terry was working with?
Yeah, I met quite a few. He was dealing with several international people, a lot of Japanese, a lot of Hungarians, and then someone who surfaced later in the news that I met as John Caffey. He later surfaced as Oliver North, but I did meet him in Oklahoma City.
Do you have any distinct memories of Oliver North?
Well, as a matter of fact, he happened to be in town when I gave birth to my oldest son, Duncan, and John Cathy, who later became known to me as Oliver North, came by the hospital with Terry and brought roses and offered his congratulations.
When you moved to Little Rock and Terry began working with Oliver North's Tantra training program, did you know then what he was doing?
Yes, to a certain extent. Peripherally, I knew what he was involved with. I preferred not to know all the details, and obviously he was not going to tell me all the details.
What was his main job in the Barry Seal operation?
It ultimately ended up working in the MENA, Arkansas area, training Contra pilots.
Who were some of the Arkansas's power elite that Terry's CIA assignment put him into play with?
Webster Hubble, of course. My husband was acquainted with Bill Clinton, Vincent Foster, a lot of that group from the Rose Law Firm were acquaintances.
After Arkansas, you and Terry moved to Mexico to work for the CIA. How did you like living in Mexico?
I fell in love with it. I mean, the people are so genuine and just wonderful, warm people. And I found it being a wonderful experience for my family.
How many children did you have when you moved there?
When we moved there, I had two. When we left, I had three.
These are all boys?
All little boys.
What was Terry doing for the CIA in Mexico, and what happened?
Terry was involved in, he had a front company. That's what was going on. We had a legitimate manufacturing operation going on down there. But in the summer of 1987, he came across some drugs, cocaine as a matter of fact, a large shipment. And once he became aware of that and I became aware of that, we decided this is not what we're down here for. We were being used, and we just wanted away from it.
Was the role of the front company, the CIA front company, normally has more than one purpose?
Terry has a manufacturing background, and he's technology is one of his true loves. He was involved in high-tech machine tool equipment, shipping it down to Mexico, trying to start up businesses down there, which is very legitimate. It's what was going on then is what is still going on now. Through this company, he also allowed weapons to be shipped through the company, and he was aware of that and went along with that. What we weren't aware of is crates were being shipped back through his company back into the United States by agents down there, and they were shipments of drugs and cocaine. And this was done with the knowledge of the U.S. government.
You became aware of this. How did you react?
Oh, I was terrified. I did not want any part of the drug world. That whole world, they have their own set of rules. I was down there. I was a mother. I had a family. I had three little boys to think about. That's not what I bargained for. I wanted out, and Terry did too.
How did you and Terry extricate yourselves from this dangerous environment?
It was just an automatic overreaction. Terry and I sat down, decided how we're going to get out of this mess. And over the course of about a month, we tried to set things in play that would get us out of there. It ended up with a fairly argumentative confrontation with one of his handlers down there, and it was not a pleasant scene. And he said, well, okay, well, we're just going back to the States. We went out of here. I don't want any more to do with this, and we're gone. And we left, and that's when our troubles began.
What were your plans as you left Mexico?
We thought we were going to the States to get help, to see Oliver North, to see the people that were behind setting us up in Mexico. We thought, well, we'll just tell them what's going on. They'll understand. They'll take care of it. We're very naive.
After returning to the U.S., what happened?
Bit by bit, we found out how deeply we were involved in this. And Terry found out more and more how much inside the inner circle he was, unwittingly and unknowingly. And based on that, I was very much a part of that, too, by virtue of the fact I was married to him. Once we got back to the States, we found out our parents were getting phone calls, suspicious phone calls, wanting to know our whereabouts. When agents started showing up at the doorstep of my mother-in-law and my parents saying they were looking for us, we got the message real fast that this was not going to be fun.
So you were being painted as drug traffickers, and agents of the U.S. government were looking for you?
They went to my sister, they went to my mother, they went to my father, they went to Terry's 72-year-old mother and threatened. They threatened family members, saying, you turn over your children, tell us where they are. If you don't, you're in trouble with the law, too, and you can be incarcerated. When we were dealing with that, with our elderly parents, seeing them being threatened, we knew this was for real, and they weren't going to be understanding. They were after us.
What did you do then?
At that point in time, we decided we're going to take off. We're going to run because, obviously, they were not being reasonable. They did not want to hear our side of the story.
How does it feel to be pursued by government agents when you've done nothing wrong?
But during the course of this, when I realized I had no one to turn to, I had no place to go. I was a citizen wronged, but where could I go? The people I thought I should be able to go to were the people that were after me. That, the level of despair when I realized that, like, I am a person without a country, that was something that was very difficult to deal with.
So you and Terry fled for your lives.
Yes. In fact, we had a motorhome and three little boys and a German Shepherd dog, and we took off, not having any idea where we were headed. Initially, we had felt that there was someone in Washington that was going to help us, but we soon came to learn we were being double-crossed. We had no idea. Nothing can prepare you for this sort of shock.
How do you feel?
My husband is a very patriotic person, as well as I am, and the fact that we thought we were doing the right thing and helping our government, helping our country, and then to have this happen, I can't tell you what it does to you as a human being. The trauma and the shock and the despair one feels, and the loneliness, thinking it's just us out here being chased.
What was your loneliest moment?
During the course of all this, when all this came about, my father had a stroke. I was there at the hospital with him when all this came down on us. I had to leave in the middle of the night with my family, and I had to make a decision. If I leave my father now, I may never see him again, but I also have three children that are depending on me, and someone is wanting to take me away from them. And I had to make a decision. It was very, very, that was probably the most difficult point of my life, when I had to leave my father in the hospital. I felt very alone, and the despair was almost more than I could imagine and bear.
How did you deal this pain?
I guess when you work through all these phases, like the shock, the denial, the anger, you know, Terry and I had to work through that in about 48 hours. We had to get through it. If we had wallowed in that and gone through all those phases, we would have been captured. We didn't have time for that. We had too many, our children relied on us, and we had too many responsibilities. So we worked that real fast and then got into the survival mode.
Where did you run to initially?
We ended up in San Diego. We spent Christmas in San Diego. We thought that's right near the border, and Terry's thought was that's the last place that the Reeds would go. That would be a stupid place to hang out, is at the border. They might be combing the borders. So do the unexpected. I mean, he had years of intelligence training, and in that facet of this whole saga, I mean, he relied on his training, and it saved us.
Dennis, what sticks in your mind about that period of your life?
It was just the feeling of despair I had that Christmas, knowing I was a wanted fugitive, and watching everyone around in the Christmas spirit, all the families singing, caroling, watching the Christmas specials. I felt I had so much pain that Christmas that I had to, I made a true attempt to keep up a facade for the children, you know, trying to sing carols with them, make Christmas ornaments. You know, I felt like a remote control. I was just a robot going through the motions. But the pain, that was my worst Christmas ever.
How old were your children that Christmas?
Baxter was a baby. He was 6 months old. Elliot was 2.5, and Duncan had just turned 5.
Did you do anything else in San Diego besides celebrate a tense Christmas?
Well, not knowing what was going on within the national computer system or the law enforcement system, we definitely were not comfortable being Terry and Janet Reed. We spent the time in San Diego establishing a corporation, establishing new identities, and once we had that taken care of, we were a little more comfortable leaving. We definitely did not want to stay there for any length of time, and we felt more comfortable being removed from our previous persons, Terry and Janice Reed.
Where did you go then?
We left San Diego and eventually ended up in Maine, which is about as far as we could drive.
As you wandered around America, how did you control your fear and your anxiety?
Yeah, I had to focus on one day at a time, and that was as a mother, as a school teacher. It was not as a fugitive from our government, and that's what kept me going. We had a motorhome. I decorated it. I put the alphabet chart up, the numbers, George Washington. We had a little school session going every day, and we had some great geography lessons. I mean, he went to most of the national parks. We saw Old Faithful. We saw Niagara Falls, and the children are standing in front of all these national monuments. We've got all kinds of photos that year. And
these government agents who were tampering in law enforcement computers, how did they portray you? What kind of lies did these renegade agents insert into the computers?
I later found out after I obtained my FBI file through Discovery that we had been labeled armed and dangerous as very nefarious characters, and that was so frightening.
Who were you the most frightened of?
I'm not saying the FBI is a bad agency or the CIA. Our concern was the renegade agents out there that are totally out of control. And that's who I was most frightened of. And the power they can wield, they are legitimate agents, and the power they have to alter your profile in NCIC. I had done nothing other than being married to Terry Reed.
What was Terry doing throughout all of this?
He's a very calculating person. He had his manual for flight instruction and how to deal with stress under pressure, and he would want me to read all these manuals. I'm like, oh, no, that's not the way I operate. No. I mean, he can sit there, remove himself from the situation, and know how he should react. I'm more emotional. I can't sit there and read how to deal with stress and just incorporate that. That's obviously much easier said than done. I got a lot of strength from him, as well as he got a lot of strength from me. He knew I was there to take care of the children. That facet of his life was being cared for by me. I knew he was there to get us out of this mess. I had to have belief that with his training and his background and knowledge that he would somehow get us out. He monitored that phase. I took care of the nurturing, the maternal, the family, and he relied on me for that. We needed each other.
Janice, what if you got separated or one of you was arrested? Had Terry covered that contingency?
We had a plan. Terry always had plan A, B, and C in envelopes, in code talk, and I had to have those memorized. We knew where we were going to rendezvous or what each plan was.
Now, how long did this last? How long were you on the run?
Over 6 months we were on the run. After that length of time, you just start to question, what are we doing? We obviously had evaded them. Terry did a very good job keeping us out of harm's way. It got to the point, though, we did feel very threatened. I've been asked before, what were you prepared to do? When I felt as a mother threatened, I would have been prepared to do anything. In fact, I got to the point, I did get a Smith & Wesson 38 caliber featherweight, and I carried it in our diaper bag. It was with me at all times because I never knew if someone was going to come barging in the door. That could happen. If they had located us, if they had put a monitor on us, they could have found us easily, barging our door in the middle of the night and trying to take us away. I was prepared to shoot, being responsible for three little boys. I felt very capable of doing what I needed to do.
How did you feel the day you stopped running?
I think we were just so worn out. I guess we still had this hope, and Terry had enough contact thinking someone might be able to take care of this line. I mean, we wanted to think that. We were told that was going on. We just didn't know. But you just get to the point, you can't do this forever. We're not being fair to our children, our families, ourselves, going through this trauma.
Then what transpired?
2.5 years in the criminal justice system. And that, I can tell you, is no fun. Our troubles were just beginning.
What do you believe led to your charges?
There was never any evidence on my part that I should ever have been indicted. In fact, I sat in the federal court one day, and the judge said, pointed to me and goes, well, I can't figure out why she's here. You know, none of us could, other than the fact I had a marriage license, and I'd married Terry Reed. And that's why I was there. I was used as a pawn to get back at Terry. I was approached on numerous occasions saying, hey, you tell us everything you know. You tell us everything about your husband, and we'll let you go. Well, first of all, I had nothing to say. And second of all, I wouldn't do that. I mean, I can't be used as a pawn. I was offended that they were trying to use me for that and putting me through the pain of the indictment process. We were both up for 20 years. I mean, living with that every day and dragging on for 2.5 years, I mean, it's amazing we survived.
Why was Terry charged?
He was set up. The problem with Terry was in some of these activities, covert activities, there's often people from the criminal world that get involved. CIA, FBI, they like to use drug smugglers or former criminals or pilots that have a record because, you know, they're compromised. Terry had no record. I mean, he had a squeaky clean background, so, you know, they need something to set him up with, which is what happened.
Was it a nightmare being in the criminal justice system?
Yes, as a matter of fact, being involved in the criminal justice system for as long as we were was a rude awakening. I found out that justice is not out there unless you have a whole lot of money. I hate to say that, but we were forced to liquidate everything we had. We had a little money at the time. That was all depleted immediately. We were forced to get 2 different attorneys, which, because of conflict, they tried to turn me against him. And after 2.5 years, we did not declare bankruptcy. However, our credit was ruined. We were nearly destitute after the fact, after we were found innocent through Freedom of Information. We found documents that would have totally exonerated us that the prosecution had within their, right there within their office that they suppressed. So the shock and the horror just continued. Initially, it was all physical, emotional, and later it was just the shock of this is the way it works, and no one is held accountable. That's what's so wrong. I sat there in the courtroom watching a prosecutor point the finger at me saying I deserve to be locked up when I had done nothing. I was found innocent. Terry was found innocent. We walked out of the courtroom that day. It's like, adios. It's been nice. It's like there's no restitution. Our lives were destroyed. Financially and emotionally, we were just devastated. It's like, sorry, I guess we made a mistake. But they don't even say that. You know, you walk out with a piece of paper, not guilty. You know, goodbye. Our system is out of control. There is no check and balance, and that's what's frightening.
Janice, do you feel this is the way the system has always worked, or have things changed?
Now, this is not the America I grew up with. In fact, I can't believe this is America. I can't believe this is what our system has degenerated to. I want to go back in time. I grew up in the 50s. I want to start over. We need to start looking back the way it used to be when people were honest, when people were accountable. That's what needs to happen because this is not the America I grew up with.
What would you like to tell the American people about the corruption within the Justice Department?
We were discussing how I felt when we were acquitted. We went through a very brief period where we thought, well, let's just start all over, you know. Let's just pick up where we left off. Well, we found we couldn't do that. we had gone through too much just to walk away from it. I knew Terry would, he couldn't live with himself. When you sit in federal court and watch state troopers and government officials sit there and perjure themselves, and the prosecutor knows that, that's not right.
But Janice, you're fighting within an obviously corrupt system. Do you honestly think you can win?
Well, I'm a 60s person. I mean, that's an inherent part of me. I still have this sense of right will prevail. And I think sometimes I'm terribly stupid to think that. But Terry and I got acquitted. I didn't think that would happen. I'm committed. I do have this belief that we can make a difference.
Terry Reed fought the Vietnam War and survived. He and Janice fought the criminal justice system, and they won against tremendous odds. They are now fighting Time Magazine and will surely prevail. And to show you just how vindictive Time Magazine became when they pulled out the stops to help get Bill Clinton elected, listen to the following tape conversation between Time reporter Richard Behar and Toshiba Machine Tool executive Takashi Osato.
Can I ask you something? Yeah. Terry says that he did some intelligence work for the FBI.
Wait, okay.
The FBI?
Uh-huh.
When he was working with Toshiba.
What?
Yeah.
I don't know what he meant.
He was working for this, the FBI. You know the FBI?
Yeah.
Trying to find out how machinery is going from Japan to America. But he was working as an agent.
Oh, really?
For the FBI.
I didn't know that. I have no knowledge about that.
In that conversation, Behar irresponsibly and for no apparent reason blew Terry Reed's cover as a spy. Up until that point, the Japanese machine tool community knew nothing about Terry's outwork with the U.S. government. Terry is now a marked man and considered a traitor by the Japanese. As Terry said earlier, desperate people can be very dangerous when cornered, especially wealthy and influential desperate people. Bessie Wright, Bill Clinton's personal friend and chief of staff for all the years he was governor, is now in Washington as one of the most influential and expensive lobbyists, exploiting and selling her relationship with the Clintons. Wright is attacking the credibility of both Terry and his book in such a below-the-belt manner that it's difficult to defend oneself. From the following comments, it's clear to see the Clintons and their machine have some tricks up their sleeves.
The book is so false as to be laughable. I mean, this man's fantasy level probably qualifies him for some kind of institutionalization. I pass mentally ill people on the streets and wonder if it's Terry Reed. This is pathetic, this person.
Terry Reed and his wife, Janice, have been fighting long, lonely battle for over 4 years, attempting to not only bring these men to justice, but to also unearth the Mina-Iran-Contra connection. They're convinced that the American public has a right to the truth. They feel they are defending the Constitution of the United States of America, and that this country should never resort to drug trafficking to finance secret foreign policy.
We don't have to say much. All you have to do is talk to the average person out there to tell you, how do you feel about your government? And the people you look at here, we're the calm ones. We're the ones that calm people down. Now, I'm speaking here as a representative for my state and other groups that I know of. The animosity that I see out there between the citizens, all of them, and the government is frightening. What they did was, after listening to all these abuses and government atrocities that you're going to hear here today, and they saw they were going to no avail, they decided to see what they could do to become part of the solution. They looked into the law, and under Title 10 USC 311, saw a phenomenon known as the unorganized militia that consists of all people, even the people taking these pictures right here, everyone. And they began to form themselves in units for their own self-defense and their self-preservation. Now, the way we stand now, and it's good that we're getting these views aired out, because 200 years ago, the British didn't get the hint until they saw dead redcoats out there. But this time, maybe we can get this out in the open and have things resolved. Because I feel, and it's concerning to me, and I'm being sincerely honest, that with the increasing polarization between the taxpaying public out here and what goes on, not only in here, but certain state governments, that the only thing standing between some of the current legislation being contemplated and armed conflict is time. It's one of the reasons I got in this movement, to help prevent that. Now, you can see from the last 2 years of sales from the firearms producers in this country, this nation is probably one of the most heavily armed forces on earth. And I have heard more and more people say, if one of these black-suited, armor-wearing, state-sponsored terrorists come kicking down my door, I'm going to blow somebody away. They don't call themselves militia. They don't even call themselves patriots. They call themselves American citizens who are getting tired of confiscatory tax rates, increasingly legislation, increasingly heavy regulations, which is, they believe, are leading them down a path to involuntary servitude. And one of the slogans that's been going around, especially in Ohio, is what I've been telling people, for those who think that this is just primarily an angry white male movement, is that if our ancestors would have been armed, they would not have been slaves. That's why people are beginning armed. Not so much with firepower. That's not the thing that makes it dangerous. What makes it dangerous is that they're being armed with knowledge. What you're going to see is a growing number of citizens, and you're seeing that now, that's why we're here, move away from the authority that is here around the in the Beltway and began to create their own constitutional authority. You're going to begin to see this in the resurgence of the common law courts. You're going to begin to receive this, and I'm going to summarize here, in the formation of the militias. That's what came first to defend ourselves. But you're also going to see this on the legislative end. You're going to see your own candidates in our own elections, and hopefully that we can become a system which will attract others into a more constitutional based system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Olson.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The following statement will attempt to answer the question of the legitimacy and the need of the citizen militia. Not only does the Constitution specifically allow the formation of a federal army, it also recognizes the inherent right of the people to form militia. Further, it recognizes that the citizen and his personal armament are the foundation of the militia. The arming of the militia is not left to the state, but to the citizen. However, should the state choose to arm its citizen militia, it is free to do so, bearing in mind that the Constitution is not a document limiting the citizen, but rather limiting the power of government. But should the state fail to arm its citizen militia, the right of the people to keep and bear arms becomes the source of the guarantee that the state will not be found defenseless in the presence of a threat to its security. It makes no sense whatsoever to look to the Constitution of the United States or that of any state for permission to form a citizen militia, since logically the power to permit is also the power to deny. If brought to its logical conclusion, in this case, government may deny the citizen the right to form a militia. If this were to happen, the state would assert itself as the principal of the contract, making the people the agents. Liberty then would depend on the state's grant of liberty. Such a concept is foreign to American thought. While the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution recognizes the existence of the state militia and recognizes their necessity for securing a free state, and while it also recognizes that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, the Second Amendment is not the source of the right to form a militia nor to keep and bear arms. Those rights existed in the states prior to the formation of the Federal Union. In fact, the right to form militia and to keep and bear arms exists from antiquity. The enumeration of those rights in the Constitution only underscores their natural occurrence and importance. According to the Tenth Amendment, ultimate power over the militia is not delegated to the federal government by the constable. Consequently, the power of the militia remains in the hands of the people. Again, the fundamental function of the militia in society remains with the people. Therefore, the Second Amendment recognizes that the militia's existence and the security of the state rests ultimately in the people who volunteer their persons to constitute the militia and their arms to supply its firepower. The primary defense of the state rests with the citizen militia bearing its own arms. Fundamentally, it is not the state that defends the people, but the people who defend the state. The second line of defense of the state consists of a statutory organization known as the National Guard. Whereas the National Guard is solely the creation of statutory law, the militia derives its existence from the inherent inalienable rights which existed before the Constitution and whose importance are such that they merit specific recognition in that document. While the National Guard came into existence as the result of legislative activity, the militia existed before there was a nation or a constitutional form of government. The militia, consisting of people owning and bearing personal weapons, is the very authority out of which the United States Constitution grew. This point must be emphasized. Neither the citizen's militia nor the citizen's private arsenal can be an appropriate subject of federal regulation. It was the armed militia of the American colonies whose own efforts ultimately led to the establishment of the United States of America. While some may say that the right to keep and bear arms is granted to Americans by the Constitution, just the opposite is true. The federal government itself is the child of the armed citizen. We, the people, are the parent of the child we call government. You, senators, are part of the child that we, the people, gave life to. The increasing amount of federal encroachment into our lives indicates the need for parental corrective action. In short, the federal government needs a good spanking to make it behave. One other important point needs to be made. Since the Constitution is the limiting document upon the government cannot become greater than the granting power. The servant cannot become greater than its master. Therefore, should the chief executive or other branch of government or all branches together act to suspend the Constitution under a rule of martial law, all power granted to government would be canceled and deferred back to the granting power, that is the people. And I'll conclude with this statement: martial law shall not be possible in this country as long as the people recognize the Bill of Rights as inalienable. My statement is not complete, however, it has been made part of the record for those who would like to review it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Olson, I heard you say on national television that you could understand why someone would bomb the Oklahoma City Federal Building. How can you say that? How can you understand why someone would bomb a building and kill so many innocent men, women, and children?
I don't believe that's the correct context, Senator Specter. I believe the context was, when they were asking me about the dynamic that occurred during following the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building, I was asked by Leslie Stahl, and I responded that I understand what took place. The good senator from Montana here earlier said that he understood why people hate their government. I don't think it's uncommon for us to seek understanding, because unless we understand a problem, we have no way of solving it. What I meant by that, and in the context, and you, Senator Specter, who soundbited Leslie Stahl, and were wrong to do so, sir, you should have got the entire... Please allow me to finish my statement, sir. You should have received the whole context and allowed me to explain it. What I said was that I understand the dynamic of retribution. Revenge and retribution are a natural dynamic which occurs when justice is taken out of the equation. Back in the Old Testament, there were the cities of refuge. You who are students of the Old Testament know that those cities of refuge were placed in the Promised Land to allow a place for a person to run if someone's life were taken, that a relative would not avenge the life of that one. That awaiting justice. When justice is removed from the equation, then the dynamic of revenge, retribution, and retaliation will take place. I understand the dynamic, sir. That is what I meant.
Well, all right, Mr. Wilson, let's not deal in sound bites. Do you now understand why someone bombed the Oklahoma City Federal Building?
The Oklahoma Federal Building, I would give that information to the FBI. I understand the dynamic, sir. It is up to you to do the investigation, and I feel that the FBI, for some reason, has taken 7 to 8 weeks to find someone who is not guilty. I think it's about time that they start looking for the ones who are guilty.
Now, we'll pursue parts of that later, but I'm not asking you for evidence as to
who bombed it, when you say you'd tell the FBI, I want to know if you understand why somebody bombed the Oklahoma City Federal Building.
That has not been proven, that somebody bombed the Oklahoma Federal Building. The fact of the matter is that one person has been taken into custody. There have been allegations made. He is an alleged bomber. I believe that we in the United States of America have to wait until the justice system takes its course. We are innocent until proven guilty. I don't know why somebody bombed. I'm saying that if someone were to be held accountable for that, and if that was the act of retaliation, revenge, or retribution, I understand the dynamics, sir, of that, because justice has been taken out of the equation. And when justice is taken out of the equation, revenge, retaliation, and retribution will take its course.
Well, whether it's singular or plural, the Oklahoma City Federal Building was bombed.
What are you looking for,
Senator? Now, what am I looking for? Well, I hadn't finished my question, but I'll answer yours. What I'm looking for is your statement about understanding why the building was bombed, whether it's singular or plural. And you talk about vengeance, and you talk about retribution, and you talk about many factors, but what I want to understand from you is whether you understand, or stated differently, think there's any justification whatsoever, given your comments on vengeance and retribution, whether there's any justification whatsoever for the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building.
Well, you're a clever attorney, sir, and I give you credit for trying to wrap my thoughts around your axle, but I'm not going to allow you to do that. Sir, it has not been proven that that person did that, nor has it been proven that that was in fact an act of retaliation, retribution, or revenge. We still have to wait the ongoing investigation. It very well may be that there was a conspiracy at higher levels, people behind those people who we have been fed by the press to accept or to believe that perhaps it was one angry individual. I say, wait, let's do the investigation. Let's wait. 3 days after John F. Kennedy was killed, everybody believed that Lee Harvey Oswald did it. Today, many of us doubt that he alone did it. And you're the single bullet theorist, and you believe that he alone did it. We don't necessarily hold to that opinion, sir.
Well, if we can leave the single bullet theory for another day.
That's your choice.
No, I will stay and discuss the single bullet theory with you when the hearings are concluded. I'll be glad to do that on the record and in public. And I'm not trying to put any words in your mouth. I'm just asking a direct question. And I'm trying to understand what you understand. I cannot understand how anybody could understand why someone would bomb the Oklahoma City Federal Building as a matter of retribution.
Well, then you don't understand the problem that we've had in Northern Ireland. You don't understand the problem that we've had in South Africa. You do not understand the hatred and the retaliation, the retribution and the revenge that has been going on around this globe since time immemorial. Then you don't understand the dynamic, sir.
Well, Mr. Olson, I may not understand, and that's why we've had these hearings, so that you could have a full opportunity to express yourself.
May I make a correction for the record, too? Senator Cole raised a poster a moment ago showing Hitler with his hand raised in the air. So that's a copyrighted poster produced by Jews for the Preservation of Firearm Ownership. It is not the work of some militia organization. So just to make that a comment for the record.
Well, we'll pick up your comment about copyrights and about Jews in a few minutes.
No, sir, I believe you're trying to lay at the feet. You're trying to lay at the feet of the militia some culpability as a responsibility. You're trying to make us out to be something that we are not, much like the press has tried to do over this last year. We are not what you think we are. We are not what the press wants to feed to the American people. We are people who are opposed to racism and hatred. We are people who love our government and love the Constitution. It has been the design and the blueprint for governments around this world. We're proud of the United States of America. But the thing that we stand against is corruption. We stand against oppression and tyranny in government. And we, many of us, are coming to the conclusion that you best represent that corruption and tyranny. There are millions, 40 to 70 million Americans out there on the other side of the Alleghenies, and there is intelligent life west of the Alleghenies, sir. And I believe that you have to talk to those people out there. You're wasting precious time.
All right. There you have it. Good wrap up to that there, the documentary there.
Let's see, get this up. Anybody want to call in, press 1. We'll be going into overtime here in about 15 minutes. So 657-383-0616. That's the number 1. So there you have it. You got the American government there, without a doubt, smuggling in cocaine. Well, we all knew that anyway. Without a doubt, smuggling in cocaine in America. Fact. It's a fact. And when asked, do you think there is even a drug war? If there is, yeah, there is against the slaves, the peons out there who get caught up in it. Yeah, who get snatched up, who have to be marked and go through the warehousing of the industrial prison complex. Yeah, we got to get those people in and play the game, the lies. How could we ever fix this system when it's built on a structure of lies? The United Snakes of America. Are there good people in this country that aren't? Of course there is. There's a lot of good people. But the good people's hands are tied. We need to untie their hands. And only we can do it. We have the keys to untie it. Unlock these locks. Let's just put them locked because they're locks. The chains that have locks on them. We have the keys to do it. But we don't want to risk anything, do we? We don't want to take a chance, do we? Other people have. And they put their lives on the line for it, but they pay the price. Every single time somebody exposes corruption somewhere, someplace, whatever, no matter what, they always got to pay some sort of price before they're rewarded or even owed the dignity of saying, hey, look what that guy did. Always. They got to pay a price. Always. I know it because I lived it. I know it. I had to pay the price. And still paying it to this day. This criminal factions, that's what I like to call it, I guess, because the whole institution itself is structured to be honest and to have due process and to have the system work. But you got greedy people. You have greedy people, and they have to be called out and pointed out. The bad people have got to be pointed out and exposed. You got to shine the light in their face, and they have a chance to repent. And we're willing to forgive them, or they got to go. They got to go. We got to clean up the trash, man. Bill Clinton was one. Bill Clinton, George Bush, same thing. Obama, and now Biden. Criminals, man. Pure criminals. And look at with Biden right now. We know his son, criminal. We know Biden's a criminal, but you can't tell. But yet we've got a majority of people out there, or a lot of people out there, that won't buy it. They will not acknowledge it. They don't care. They argue with you. We've argued with them many times. Come on, man. Just admit it. They're criminals. I'll back Trump. And don't play the Republican-Democrat game with me. Don't play it. It's not going to work. All right, let's take some calls here. 907 and 214. I'll just go ahead and unmute you. Go ahead.
Well, I kind of got in a little late, Joe. I don't have anything to say right at the moment.
All right. How about who's it? I'm a gunslinger there. How you doing?
It's a crazy situation that we're in. I mean, if we don't get out of this situation, we're going to sink. You ever heard like a rock? We're going to sink like a rock.
Yeah.
If this system is not dismantled, that's the only way it's going to happen, okay, is to dismantle the system and start all over system, like a big old reset button, okay, you know, the tilt button, the reset button. How else is it going to do? I mean, these people are going to have to be dealt with harshly. And,
yeah,
you know, just saying, Mother, may I please, not going to work anymore. 50 years ago, it might have worked. It ain't going to work today. Okay? It ain't going to work today.
Yeah.
I don't know how you're going to do it. I don't know what measures is going to have to be taken. But at some point, if we don't, we all might as well pack up and move to bumfuck Egypt, buddy. Because this country ain't going to exist anymore.
Well, let me ask this then. Let me just say this. We all say about Donald Trump getting elected, and we all hear about him draining the swamp, and he's gonna clean up things, and we got to clean stuff up. How? That's a good question. How do we do it? How do we? How would Trump do it? How do we do it? How do we get, you know?
Well,
what do we do?
It's going to take more than 4 or 8 years. Hopefully Trump gets in there again, he better, and start or continue where he left off. He did start to drain the swamp a little bit. Okay, you got to give him credit. You got to give credit where credit is deserved. And he did expose the lies and the corruption and all this stuff. Trump is only one man. Okay, he puts on his pants one leg at a time like everybody else does. Okay, so when Trump gets back in there, it's for 4 years, even after Trump, somebody is going to have a mindset of the same caliber, like a gun, same caliber, to keep the swamp draining. It's not going to be able to be drained overnight. Because it didn't get shitty overnight. It took decades, okay, for this swamp to get a stinky cesspool like it is now, okay. So I wish there was a magic pump that we could just throw in there like a pool guy does. Just go in there and just suck all that nasty, stinking crap water out of your pool. But unfortunately, it doesn't exist. So
I don't think we could do it. I don't think we could do it because we got to arrest and prosecute. We got to arrest and prosecute the people that have gotten away with murder, basically.
Yeah, that's true. We've got, like I said, the judicial system is going to have to be completely revamped. When you let these son of bitches out, I was just reading earlier today or yesterday, there's just some punk there in New York City was going down, walking down the street, just hitting people, cold cocking them. Right in their back, sticking up on him, right? He got arrested. Sure, he'll be out on the street in 2 hours. That's the kind of shit that's got to stop.
Yeah.
They need to be locked up. I don't care if you've got mental illness. Put them in a nut farm, okay? If we don't start locking these people up, okay, and locking the who's the keepers of the keepers? Who's going to oversee all this shit?
How do we stop people? How do we stop people from acting like that to begin with? I mean, that's the point. How did this happen?
Because New York is gone. I wish we could take a big cutting torch and cut New York State out of the United States. And they just float out there in the ocean and sink like the freaking Titanic. And take the city of New York with it, okay? All the libtards, all that crap that they did they did it to themselves. Nobody else did it to them. They did it to themselves, okay? Now we can do a sigh of relief. Whew, them fuckers are gone, okay?
Well, you see, I got somebody in the chat room saying, Trump gave you warp speed, Sherlock, 666. Now, what did Trump do that was wrong? What did he do? What did he do?
He listened to a bunch of jackasses that he shouldn't have listened to. I even disagree with what he did, okay? He listened to people that he shouldn't have listened to, okay? You know, Dr. Fauci calling Dr. Quack, okay? That one fucker he shouldn't have listened to right there. But being a new politician like Trump, he was green, okay. He probably said, they may know better than me, or, talking in Trump's place, obviously. So we'll do it this way for a while. Well, obviously that didn't work, okay. It fucked up the whole damn thing. So I think this time he's learned his lesson. Not to listen to people and do it on his own instinct. You know, that's usually the first thing that usually is the right thing is your gut instinct. The first thing that you feel on a situation is what you should do right then and there. And that usually works out the best of the deal. Okay. But if you listen to these people that have their roots have grown out of their asses so deep, well, like Feinstein, that freaking Jew. Look how long that bitch has been in there. Okay, thank
well,
God.
Dead. Oh,
the Grim
dead
Reaper.
Well, she's gone, thank God.
Yeah, thank God the Grim Reaper called her number, no doubt about it, because she was the most anti-American communist bastard bitch
well,
that
you
I
know,
ever...
Well, check this out. You know Lieberman just died. Lieberman from Connecticut. I knew Lieberman. I saw things that he did. I knew people that worked in his office. He was a part of the of a lot of dirty crap that had a lot of money that helped build prisons up there. Trust me. Oh, you know, with Blumenthal.
He was a dirty son of a bitch. Good riddance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good riddance.
Yeah.
A lot more
I mean,
needs to take that path.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but you know, if we don't get rid of these career politicians that have been in there since goddamn dinosaurs walked the earth, then those situations are never going to change because they're not going to change it. They have seated themselves
also
so
have a
good,
divide, though,
making so much damn money. Huh?
We also have a divide, though, Gunslinger. We've got a divide amongst the people. Like, for instance, just even on this podcast show, you see, we've got people in the chat room that are talking. He's talking about, I got to study hour 6666. I mean, well, how much more do I need to study? I mean, about what? What, that's going to teach me about Trump, you're saying? You know? I mean,
it's common sense. It's common sense. That's what's wrong with this freaking country today, because common sense had been flushed down a toilet a long time ago, okay? Remember there was a black dude on YouTube, the doctor of common sense, E.T. Williams, okay, if you ever listened to him. Yeah, he's right on the money. He tells it like
really?
It is, okay? And, oh, yeah, look him up. Yeah, E.T. Williams, the doctor of common sense. And I think he moved to Spreaker. Or something.
Really? I never heard of him. I'll look him up, though. But let me get a private caller here. Let's go ahead and unmute him.
Look him up, man. He's right on the money.
Private caller, go ahead.
Hey, Joel Gibson. How are you, sir? Hey, this is Brother Mike.
I'm doing all right.
You know, one thing
all
I
right,
want
Michael.
To let you know. You know, yesterday I was talking about Ukraine, and you cut me off, but then Sarge came and talk about Ukraine for 30 minutes and said we don't like to send money to Ukraine. But why you guys cut me off? Can you please explain to me? And why
I don't, because I couldn't hear you. Because I couldn't hear you. Mike, pay attention, because I couldn't hear you. That's why. Because I got a lot of people on the line. Sometimes your phone is real low, and with your accent, it's a little bit hard to hear you. So that's what I was, you know, so I meaning to tell you that.
My friend, you have a North Carolina accent, too. Everybody has accent. So that doesn't mean that we cannot come to compromise, you know, my friend. But that's fine. I accept you. No problem. But please, you know, let your show grow very good everywhere. But please control the chat room. Let them, if I'm talking right now, nobody should talk over me, or vice versa, when any of you guys, or even yourselves, you are the host. When you are talking, we have to be listened to you with love and attention, you know? And then if we have a response, say, is it my turn, or can I talk about your comments, please? And that's it. You make your show better and better and better, my friend. So regarding Singapore, I talked to you yesterday. Singapore ship that crashed to that beautiful bridge that is, you know, long time. I mean, is everywhere. It's famous. The Spring Banner. A bridge, you know, so we know that was a great message to America. And we know that how is that possible? That ship, exact time of the unable to stop and hit the bridge, and suppose they had the bad gasoline, you know, they keep saying it. That gasoline they put into the ship, so ship couldn't work correctly, and they couldn't stop the ship, and bullshit. This was a 9-1 of Maryland. And right now,
I don't buy that, Mike.
Okay, I'm not finished yet. I know, excuse me, I'm not finished yet. But But the question is, you know, the shortage of food and et cetera. Right now they're closing it for a long time. It's almost like a COVID time. So in Easter of the United States, so even Midwest may experience shortage of the food, my friends. But, you know, to me, this was a great message to America. And with the eclipse, we had just full moon two, three days ago, on 25th. So it's a lot of events are coming. Leukemia right now.
Mike, hang on one second. 60 seconds. Mike, hang on one second. 60 seconds, everybody. We're going into overtime. So 657-383-0616. If you want to call in now. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to get in. All right, go ahead, Mike.
Okay, sir. Thank you very much, sir. You know, so now we see the Lutenia. Germany, they have sent thousands of tanks and army to the very, like, 2 miles from Lutenian borderline. And guess what? Belarus has sent all their army like 8 miles away from the borderline with Lutenia right now. I mean, series of chain events we are going to see witness in all over the world. An increased earthquake, as I have told you guys before, we had 6.4 in Manitoba, we had 5.8 in Oregon, and many aftershocks. It was near, of course, it's offshore, but, you know, in middle of the Oregon. But bottom line is this. We are going to witness calamities after calamities and a lot of disasters, tornadoes, I mean, mass snow, mass weather outage. And so, and also put the final verdict that Ukraine was responsible for what Moscow did. So now they are very pissed and they will take action very soon. Maybe soon after the eclipse or a little bit before eclipse. So within the springtime, maybe I said 2 months, but there are a series of chain events is going to come that's shaking the whole planet, my friends.
Let's get back to the ship, Mike. Let's get back to the ship. What? Let's get back to the bridge and the ship. Let's get back to that. Okay, look. I can appreciate your opinion on that. But hey, look, everybody, you know, starts jumping off, putting the tinfoil hats on. It's a conspiracy with a terrorist, and, you know, this, that, the boogie. But, oh, Osama bin Laden's alive again. Maybe he swam up there. It's just all, look, it was an accident. Accidents happen, okay? It was an accident. No terror attack.
Let me quote on that, since I'm sort of an engineer here. Okay, let's look at the thing, okay? It came from a different country, okay? Their safety record is fucked up, okay? They don't do maintenance on them things worth a flip, and we know it, okay? Because it's not U.S. regulated under the, you know, the safety and the shipping and all that stuff. What was it coming from? Pakistan or one of them damn countries over there, okay? All right. Now, you have to understand physics, okay? They had already had safety issues with the propulsion system, meaning probably the engine. It's only got one engine in it. It's a diesel. The thing's probably about half as big as your house. It's a big son of a bitch. It's only got one propeller, one prop, okay? Big old diesel, okay? Now, this thing is it's almost 1,000 feet long, okay? It weighs 150,000 tons, not pounds, tons. So that's over 250,000 pounds. Now, this thing was going at 10 miles an hour. For a ship that size, that's hauling ass, okay? For a ship that size. Now, if you were to lose power for the diesel stopped or for whatever reason, you're not stopping that thing for at least 2 miles. I don't care if you drop both anchors and drag your feet. You're not stopping that ship for at least 2 miles. Same thing with a train. You think a train can stop on a dime? No. It takes at least a mile to 2 miles, going 60 miles an hour, to stop a train dead stop. And that's probably locking up every damn wheel on it. Ships don't have wheels, okay? They float. They're on the ocean, okay? So even if they drop the anchors and they weigh 10 tons apiece, go look them up, it wouldn't stop. They couldn't stop it in time. And on top of that, the video shows a huge black smoke coming out of the smokestacks. Now, I'm not a diesel mechanic, but I bet you if you talk to a diesel mechanic, that means that diesel engine is under full load. That means they were probably reversing. It was probably in reverse. Now, you can't reverse a diesel. It's like a car engine. You can't make your car engine run backwards. But you'd go through a transmission or a gearbox. That's probably what they were doing. There's the captain or whoever was on there in charge was probably ordering full reverse. And then the engine quit. Well, there goes your full reverse. Okay. And then it went out of control. Even with the port and starboard thrusters on the bow, they're not big enough to maneuver that big, heavy ass out of the way. It's an accident. Okay. Things happen, you know?
Okay, sir, after you finish, I would like to give my feedback to you, sir. Go ahead, sir.
Go ahead. No, I'm done. I'm pretty much done until, it's physics.
No.
Once things are in motion, you know,
yes,
it's hard
when
to stop something that big.
When you see
know?
That it's a breach over there, first you have to get the clearance from the tower. That yes, it's okay. Go ahead and proceed. Proceed. But they did not give him any kind of clearance, and they did it. So please don't say an accident, because it's like, you know, police. They tell you, come. It's okay. You know, come. Go to the next line, etc. But if police is keeping hands on. That means a stop, and you keep going. That's not any more accident. That's called manslaughter. That's called voluntary accidents, and etc. So this was done, like murder one. So therefore, we Americans are not as stupid as other people think we are. We are very, very, very much up to date. And we know what the hell is going on around the globe and plus around our country, beloved country. You know? But, I mean, you can have your theory. I have no problem with it. But it's a little bit not – it's off, my friend. What do you think?
No, well, it's not off. You know, it's not off because I'm a retired master electrician, electrical engineer. I know how these things work. I'm not a ship. I never worked on a ship, but I know how physics works. I know how the law of motion works.
20 miles away. You're 20 miles away, sir. As high as that possible, you keep going through more. Hey, the tower has to give you an eye. It's like a jet. Okay, when the jet is landing in Los Angeles Airport, okay, they communicate all the time with the tower, and if somebody is always responsible for the flight XYZ number, for example. Until they don't get approval, go ahead and land, because they have all the radars, they have all the information, they know it's safe. Go ahead and land. That pilot is not going to go land in Los Angeles Airport without approval of the tower. Okay, and if it does, it's going to create a major accident, and it happened in India that two jumbo jets, more than 500 passengers, each 1,000 passengers died, you know? So
stick to the ship, though. Why? Well, you're saying the ship was 20 miles away? How long, the ship was, before it started, I mean, I don't get it. I don't get what you're saying about the ship.
No. I'm saying that the ship knows that 10 miles, 20 miles is a bridge over there. They have to communicate with everything that the bridge is going up. If if there is no indication that it's safe to come closer and closer, then cannot go. You have to stop your ship 20 miles range or within 10 mile range at the minimum to make sure
Mike,
that
they didn't lose
works.
Power. Mike, they didn't lose power until they were so far away. They weren't 10 miles away. You know, they were close to the bridge.
Mike,
they had
permission to move inside the harbor. They were exiting the harbor. They had two harbor pilots on board that ship.
Right.
The harbor master knew where that ship was and was exiting the harbor.
Okay, but unfortunately, we American people are not down. This was not an accident. This was more than one. You know, this was especially done, and I'm sure they put it paid money to these people. And because you know Singapore ship, you know that they have international people work there. There are many people work from Russians, maybe even Ukrainian, and etc. They paid money and they still sabotage it. Let this happen. This is a great message. It means if you hit our
But why, Mike? That it only killed 7 people. That bridge is broken and they're going to put it right back up again. Probably in a couple months, they're going to have traffic flowing right through over there again. I mean, so it wasn't a devastating attack. It was not, if you're saying it's an attack, it was an accident. Accidents happen. You know, that's the thing. You know what I mean?
Machines break down. Your car breaks down, don't it? You ever seen a perfect car? I'd love to have one. Machines break down. Trust me. They do. All the time, every day, day in, day out. And it's a bigger machine.
There is one thing that I have heard, but I can't verify right now, was that the maintenance record on that ship were piss poor. I mean, the ship was in bad shape to begin with, the engine room. Okay.
Yep.
And the other thing about this particular ship was, this ain't its first bumper cars that it's played.
Yes.
It's hit other things, I guess. It's collided with other things. This isn't the first time that ship's had an accident. That's what he's trying to say, Mike.
But not like it. This is a special bridge.
Well, yeah, not like
carton.
This.
I mean, it has a big heart on our hearts, you know, and it's one of the biggest, I mean, important. It's like, you know, a freedom statue in New York. I mean, what do you think? It's similar. We cannot compare that. That's more important. Or this. Both of them is the same importance in the United States of America.
But Mike, if it was an attack, why wouldn't they do it during rush hour then? Why wouldn't they do it during rush hour? Why would they do it at 1:30?
33,000 people. 33,000 people go over that bridge every day. How come they didn't wait until rush hour? Because they wanted the big bucks.
Yeah.
It was 1:30 in the morning. So it's an accident.
Yeah.
There ain't no conspiracy.
Yeah.
Come on, give me a break.
I mean, we know the Mississippi. We know Mississippi bridge came down, okay? That was because of the poor construction, because of the mal construction, and because of the, you know, lack of care and construction. The Mississippi bridge came and about 56 or say 100 people approximately died and injured. But,
yeah,
I agree with you, Mike.
But, you know, that's dangerous narrative, because every time somebody has an accident or somebody smashes into something, oh, it's a terrorist attack, you know, and that puts us, you know, and that's not right. We can't do that. You know, I mean, we got to be careful, you know. I mean, when we start, you know, we start pointing, you know,
Are you saying, so what about the Moscow attack? Can you please elaborate on your Moscow attack, please? Comparison. If you compare it with the Moscow attack and what the breach happened, both has a lot of commonality, my friends. Go ahead, please.
How does the Moscow attack compare to the bridge attack? Yeah, what's the commonality on that? I don't get it. Educate.
Okay, commonality is both are destroyed. Destruction. The other ones, they destroyed like
okay.
over 140 people and over close to 200 injured. But then in this one, the very beautiful bridge with a lot of commonality, with lots of love and importance, not only United States, importance in the globe it had. So that's basically, that's destroyed. That's why many people think that is end of American dream.
It's not shutting down the economy.
Mike,
go ahead, Mark.
Mike, as a target, okay, looking for a target, that port, while it's busy, is not a very, very busy port compared to the rest of them. Secondly, okay, the only thing that they have done to damage that port and infrastructure, excuse me, is to drop that bridge into the water, which means that port right now is closed for any business.
That's what I'm saying to you guys, but you don't get it until you
for
say,
for the next couple months.
Okay, maybe next couple of months, they say, you know, by the time material comes from China. Materials come from other countries, okay?
Right.
And by the time we get it kept together, by the time we try to repair, an unrepairable bridge, we have to actually rebuild everything pretty much. You cannot just say, okay.
That bridge is not shutting down the economy in the Northeast, Mike. That bridge does not shut down the economy. The economy is just fine.
Uh-huh.
They're still shipping.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Okay, you say
the
there
bridge,
is no shipping. So if there is no shipping,
the bridge,
so that means economy, there will be shortages in East and possibly Midwest. That's what I'm saying, my friends.
The port will be open within 1 to 2 months.
Okay.
As soon as they get the bridge. Wait. The port will be open in 1 to 2 months. Maybe a little bit longer until they get the debris out of the channel.
Okay.
At that point, the port will be open. The bridge will not be rebuilt at all, but the port will be open and commerce will be flowing again into and out of that port.
Okay, you say between 2 months, I say 6 months. Okay, let us get the midpoint 4 months. 4 months, okay, you said, if I'm correctly, you said that the port would be closed. So then how the free of the food and goods going and come back?
You have other ports, Mike. Mike, now you have other harbors and ports in the Northeast. You got Long Wharf in New Haven area, Long Island Sound. You got New York Harbor, the Hudson. You got all kinds. You got the Tappan Zee Bridge. You got all kinds of ports over there. That port doesn't
fund the
Northeast.
Right. You know what they show from our TV stations that, you know, there are like many ships are waiting, like they don't know what the fuck to do anymore. So do you see that?
They were designated to go to that harbor,
ship,
that port, but now they got to get rerouted.
Ship,
that takes time.
Ship,
okay.
The ships
those,
that are the ships,
resources, all of those takes the timing, and all of them. Every time the goods are not reached to the destination on time, it's like a truck driver. If a truck driver pick up from New York the goods to go to Los Angeles, for example, and due to the bad weather, we can say through.
Mike, the warehouses are full. We have warehouses filled. We have warehouses that are full with supplies. We're not. The economy is not going to be destroyed. We're not going to suffer. We won't even see it, probably. We won't even feel it, you know. So it's nothing. Trust me, it's nothing.
I hope so too.
The ship,
there will be shortage of a lot of things in East Coast for sure, and possibly Midwest until everything, as you claim, that is going to happen and clear everything, and then free of the goods and backups.
Mike,
it's like California. You remember California?
Mike,
they had over 100 ships. They were waiting to go and put their goods in California during the strike or during the so many disputes that happened in California, you know. So you know how much services, parts are missing, you know, in West Coast. And, you know, everything went haywire, my friends.
But Mike,
sometimes we don't want to admit it, sometimes half admit it, and sometimes not. But I think we are screwed. Not only we are screwed, the whole world is going to be screwed in coming months, because Putin is already put their nuclear bombs outside their place into the jungles now. And then they cover it with a special
Mike, what are you talking, Mike, you went from the bridge, Mike, you went from the bridge to nuclear bombs. Alaskan, go ahead, he wants to say something. Go ahead, Alaskan, go ahead.
No, I was going to say
the port is not a major port, Mike. The ships that were at dock inside the port when the bridge came down are stuck. The ships that were en route to the port are not stuck. They are being rerouted to other ports to offload their goods. There's a little there's going to be a little hiccup in the supply chain. Yes, there will be.
Okay.
But
so we are
it's not permanent.
So I say the same thing as you say, and you say the same thing as I say. But I may say a little bit different. Maybe
all
you
right,
don't.
So, okay, we might
it.
Not get our toothpaste for a little while. We might not get our toothpaste and a couple rolls of toilet paper, okay? That's okay. All right? We'll be okay.
That's the next one. You sandpaper.
Yeah.
Hey, I was going to ask Boyd, how do you think they're going to get that debris out of there? You think they're going to cut it up with a cutting torch, or are they going to blast it? What's left of that bridge?
They'll most likely, the steel portions, they'll probably cut and raise them, get them out of the way. The concrete that's there, depending on how much damage it took, they might have to pop that a couple times to get rid of it so they can put in a new piling. But as far as the bridge structure itself, they'll be cutting it up.
Oh, that's exactly is bad for all of us, because that bridge, as I said, it's very, very important. It's in the heart of us and yourself and everybody else, you know. So that means destruction. That's true. Destruction is part of construction, and construction is part of destruction. That's true. But,
yeah.
I mean...
It's
going to
create jobs,
Mike.
It's going to create jobs, actually. It's actually going to help the economy, probably.
The economy in that area, okay,
mm-hmm.
will shift a little bit. It will not come to a complete standstill, but it will shift a little bit. Like if they got container ships that are stuck in port right now with containers on them, they are most likely going to offload those containers off of those ships, truck them to either another port or to the railroad so that they could be taken to another port and shipped. Yes, there's going to be a delay in the outbound shipments. The inbound shipments coming to that port, they're going to have a little bit of a delay because they're going to go to another port, and the containers on those ships will have to be either hauled by truck or by train to get to their destination. Yep. But they're not going to, it's not going to stop.
You know, Mike, get back to, you know, I played a documentary about the government shipping cocaine into the country. You know, I mean, that these are the crimes. We have a corrupt government. We have a system, a justice system that is corrupt. You know, we have a phony war on drugs. I mean, these are the things that are destroying America. These are the things that are destroying because we're being eaten from within, destroyed. You know, I mean, when we have the corruption is what's going to destroy us, not a terrorist attack. We're the most secure, safest country in the world. You know, I mean, we're only thing that destroys us from within. And as far as a war with Russia, you know, I know people disagree with me. Go ahead.
Joe, my friend, you see, yes, British Empire divide us with Trump, Biden, or whoever else it is, but and then many other things, classes, white, black, yellow, etc. You know what will happen? Is on the British people, they like us to kill each other. And if we do that, shame on us. If we take the bait of the British Empire, this country doesn't need anything else. We kill ourselves. Russia will not put one atom bomb up. Ayatollahs will be happy, and North Korea will be happy, China would be happy. So, therefore, British Empire fucked up Iran, my ex-country, okay? They brought Khomeini, that we didn't know who the fuck was he in my ex-country. And we didn't go really to see him, but, you know, some poor people, you know, like they say, okay, let's go out to see who the fuck Khomeini is. And then the radio and the TV and CNN would say millions of, 10 millions of Iranians went to see Khomeini. No, because people didn't know who the fuck Khomeini was. But luckily he came, and then they took the power in Iran, and then destruction started, and then we say shame to Jimmy Carter, and we never forgive Jimmy Carter for selling Iran to Ayatollah, selling the Shah of Iran to Ayatollah. And when he came down from Air France, you know what happened? The reporters.
Yeah, but Mike, Iran is not a threat to the United States at all. Iran, okay. The only thing that can, the only thing that would be a threat is Russia, because Russia controls the nuclear reactors in Iran. That's it. That's the only thing. And but I would, Israel could wipe out Iran in a second. You know, they go bomb them, and that would be it.
Iran right now has 2 dozen atom bombs. And right now, Iran is under umbrella of Russia and China, my friend. So Ayatollahs, I mean, not Iran. Iranian people love the United States. Iranian people, 90%, they love the whole world. We have no problem with nobody. But the question is,
they're in the streets shouting death to America. They're in the streets shouting death to America.
Those are not represent any of the Iranian people because they pay the money. You know, here too in the United States, if somebody comes and pay you,
I can see that. I can see that happening. Okay, I can agree with you there. Okay.
Right? My friend, it's the same policy. It's the same shit, crap, because people are hungry. When people are hungry, they say, okay, give me, $10. Okay, $10 for
you. But, Mike, it's not our problem. You know what? I'm a guy that says it's not our problem. We don't need to worry about Iran. Don't worry about it. Mind our own business. We need to worry about our problems over here. You know, secure our borders. You know?
That's exactly is Iran is the problem for United States of America, because as long as Ayatollah exists in Iran and taking hostages of Iranian people, for 90% of Iranian people are hostages of Ayatollah.
Mike, Iran is no threat to the United States. Iran is no threat to the United States.
No, don't say that.
How?
How many times Iranian proxy that they support, Iran send them all
never.
The missiles?
Never. Iranians have never attacked the United States. Iran has never attacked the United States, except for that hostage problem in the 1970s. That's because the Americans were over there. The Iranians can't come over here and attack us. They can't reach us. They have no military capability to reach us. What are they going to, they're not going to get it. What are they going to do, send a guy strapped with a bomb to go blow up a store in New York City? Big deal.
How many times that Iranian proxy attacked the United States in Iraq and Syria and Iraq?
Yeah,
and,
okay, we need to get out of there. It's none of our business to be over there. We need to withdraw our people from over there,
The question is, fingerprint of the terrorist regime of Iran is everywhere, my friend. Everywhere. So as long as Ayatollah is not to be destroyed by the West or by Israel, we pray every day Israel attack Iran, my friend. Why? Because we need freedom in Iran for any price. Because
the country
Iranian
would plunge into a civil war. The country would plunge into a civil war. There'd be chaos, Iraq.
No. It won't go. People are united in Iran, but they don't have the correct tools to over the Ayatollahs. You know how many times the woman, life, freedom, how many times these people went in the street and they have no hijab, no burqa, like Afghanistan.
What do you want the United States to do then? What do you want them to do? I don't get it. What do you want? You want us to attack Iran?
First of all, Joe Biden doesn't have the balls to do that. That's number one.
I got that.
Okay. We are waiting for the Donald Trump to come because he has the biggest balls. So, and hopefully for him. And if he doesn't, he needs to order attack within the second day of his presidency to Iran.
He can't do that, Mike. He can't do that. The president can't declare war on a country. The president can't attack another country. That's unconstitutional. He can't do that. He has to get a declaration of war from Congress.
Because Iran is with Russia and China. David Kellogg's Persian Gulf, your price of gas in California will be $20, my friend, and $15 in New York or North Carolina that you live, $13. So what
no,
are you going
we,
to
we,
do?
We start doing, Donald Trump's in office, we start being self-sufficient again. We start fracking our own gas. We start making our own fuel.
Drilling our own oil. Yep,
okay.
Right.
But the price of gas, right now, price of gas has gone up. How much is in North Carolina, my friend?
$3.40 a gallon right now.
Okay. In California, it's over more than $5 right now.
$5 a gallon in California?
Right. There is no
Persian gold. All right. What's it in Texas, gunslinger?
I think I've seen it yesterday for $3.26.
$3.26. Alaskan up there in Alaska, what's gas up there for you?
Where? Probably around $3.50 mark.
$3.50? So it's $3.25, $3.40 a gallon right now across the country. You say it's $5 in California. They're expensive out there. But that's because you have libtards out there running your country. Your state. That's why.
So, but wait, until Persian Gulf will be closed by Ayatollah, and then what you're going to do?
We don't get all our fuel from Iran. We get it from Saudi Arabia. We don't get nothing from Iran.
Persian Gulf is going to be closed. Nobody can move one inch over, So. It will be 20% of the world.
Then we got oil fields in Texas, Gulf of Mexico. We can go to Alaska. We got plenty of oil here in America. We ain't got to worry about that.
Why your gas is not $1 right now, my friend?
Because we're bought out by OPEC, and because we got Biden as president right now.
Read it again.
The reason that it's not $1 is all them damn taxes. 98% of a gallon of gas is tax.
Okay.
So there you go. Yeah. I mean, I know. I live here.
Biden shut down.
Biden shut down
that pipeline. He shut down that pipeline. Biden shuts down. He's against coal, the coal industry, natural gas. Yep. I mean, you know, when Trump gets back in there, we'll be self-sufficient again. You'll see gas probably come down to about $2 a gallon, $2.25 a gallon. You know, because the taxes, like Gunslinger said, that's why it'll be that much. But that's what it'll probably be. You know, I mean, if Trump gets back in there, that's what's going to happen, Mike. But it only lasts for a few years. When Trump's out, what's going to happen then? We're screwed again. I think Trump, I don't know, to be honest with you. I don't want to make predictions. I don't know what the hell is going to happen anymore. I don't even know if Trump gets elected or not. I don't know. Who knows? We might not even make it to the damn election. You know? I don't even know.
That's what I'm saying. Because the things are very series of chain events and calamities that's coming to the world. Yes, you are right. We may not have even any elections in the United States of America because, you know, the missiles from Russia already pinpointed at all 500 cities in the United States and other
ones. They've been that way since they've been that way since Russia made nuclear weapons. They've been pointing at us. We already know that Russia's not going to launch a nuclear strike. If they do that, it's destruction. They will be annihilated, and we'll be annihilated too. So what's the point? They know this. They know this. You know, we'll be completely destroyed.
There is no winner. There is no loser, my friends. We know that. There is no winner or losers. But the question is, right now, I mean, Ukraine keep attacking inside the Russia. I mean, imagine if Mexico keeps sending their drones and attacking the San Diego oil refineries and et cetera. What we do? We just sit and say, hey, it's a la vie. No.
That's why we
got to
get out of Ukraine. We got to get you out of Ukraine. Ukraine's none of our business.
Okay, I accept you. But yesterday I was talking about the same Ukraine and kind of we were disconnected, or you said to Sarge, how are you doing, Sarge? And Sarge went and said the same thing that I was saying it too. So we have a commonality, many commonality right now. But, you know, but tonight is better. I like it tonight.
Okay, what happened in Kyiv? Kyiv missile hit or whatever in Ukraine a couple hours ago? What happened?
Always Ukraine is attacking inside the Russia. Many parts of Russia, oil refineries in Russia, and many strategic places in Russia, okay? So, technically, Zelensky is trying to do anything that Russia, you know, to breach the Article 5.
Oh, okay, hang on, Mike. All right. Russia attacked Ukraine. That's what happened. Okay, they launched a bunch of missiles towards them. Okay. That's why I was trying to look what happened. Kyiv got attacked by a bunch of Russian missiles. That's what happened. They got bombarded. So that's what happened.
I mean,
okay.
Lushenkov, I mean, he was just within the 10 miles of the Lutenia yesterday, and he has a nice dog, white dog. I mean, he was there in the uniform of the military, and then he told his forces, can we do it? They said, yes, sir, we are ready to do it. And today we saw German tanks went towards Lutenia 2 miles from the borderline with Russia. So, my friend, you see, we are so close to the series of chain events, and, you know, that's whether it's going to be the limited nuclear bombs or maybe massive nuclear bombs.
Not going to be nuclear. There will not be a nuclear war in this world. We're not going. The world's not going to be destroyed by nuclear bombs. I assure you of that. Not going to happen.
But
it doesn't make sense.
But you know, limited. That means Russia will nuke Ukraine, and Ukraine has nothing, and they own. Russia will own it in 5 minutes. But the same thing we did Nagasaki and Japan. Okay. We were war with Japan. We had no other choice to put little bomb and a bigger bomb of atom bomb to Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Okay?
Yes, I know that.
So same thing Russia can do easily, nuke it, and say, well, that's Slavy, Ukraine, and then what will happen? You see what I'm saying?
Russia's not going to use nuclear weapons. And if he did use them in Ukraine, nobody's going to do nothing. NATO's not going to attack Russia. Nobody's going to attack Russia, trust me.
Okay,
they're not going to start a nuclear war over Ukraine.
That's called limited nuclear attack. That's what I said.
Yeah. All right. Well, let them. Personally, Ukraine, if you ask me, Ukraine's been in war, but always wars. They've been in World War II. I mean, they're always a problem. It's none of our business. I don't give a damn about Ukraine. The only reason why I would support Ukraine is because I don't like Russia.
So we are in agreement. We are always in agreement. It's none of our business held with them. Well, I mean, we have no more ammunition in the United States, and we keep sending $6 trillion, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe $5 trillion. Between that much, approximately. Okay, maybe a little bit more, a little bit less, but between $5 to $6 trillion we send. So imagine $6 trillion divided by what? We are 400,000 Americans in USA. Okay.
We can send them $100 trillion. It doesn't matter. We have a machine. We have a machine that prints the money, so it doesn't matter. It's called the Federal Reserve Banking Cartel.
If they divide that between all about, how much we get? You would be top of the shape. But that's never happens. Unfortunately, war is destruction, peace is construction, and unfortunately, the British Empire is causing, right now they own Canada. You know that. Canada belongs to the British Empire.
I don't know about that. Mike, I don't know about all that. I mean, all I can tell you is this.
Therefore, British Empire wants to own us and enslave us to death. So if we take their bait, they divide us.
Not the British
Empire. It's shame on us. We have to be unity in diversity, and we have to respect each other. We have God is love. That's the bottom line. Go ahead, my friend.
The New World Order is not the British Empire, but there's a lot of things. I mean, I don't know what. Your foreign policy thoughts are just like way out there. I don't know. Well, I mean, I understand where you're coming from with Iran and everything, but you're just way out there. I mean,
because we become American citizens, but we brought other experiences to the community, to the Americans as well too. Have you ever talked to your Beirut or people from Lebanon? You tell them what happened in Lebanon. The 15 years civil war they had between Druze, between Shia, and between Christian.
Mike, there's a Muslim fighting over there. Yes, I know. I understand the Middle East and everything. It's a politics.
No.
I got that.
Experiences that they had and what happened. Again, British Empire, they did that and put these three different people against each other and created a mass for close 15 years, approximately. And so, at the end, they came to the point. At the point, they came saying, okay, we live in one country together, happy and et cetera, but they... So many people killed, so many Christian phalanges died, so many Shia died, so many Druze did die, and etc. Why? Because they took the bait of the British Empire. That's all. Otherwise, it wasn't going to happen. So British Empire, they have damaged a lot of countries around the globe, and if we want peace and unity, and if we want to have a country, we should be cool at it all the time. Even if somebody speaks against what you believe, okay? But we should have a constructive discussion. And, we all always have some differences. We cannot come and say, okay, everything I say, you believe, everything you say, I believe, or et cetera. But at the end, we have many commonalities. So that's what it costs. That's what
friends with all, alliances with none. That's what I say. George Washington says. What do you guys think, Gunslinger? Friends with all, alliances with none.
Yep. Well, you know, but like, you know, like you said, you know, there's never going to be a nuclear war in this country. It would be a mutual destruction on both ends. Okay. You ever heard? You ever seen the movie called War Games? Okay.
Yep.
What did that stupid computer say? The best thing to do is not to play the game. Okay.
Yeah.
And these people know it. I mean, we know it. The Russians know it. Whoever else has the nukes and everything. If one of these shitball little countries was to try to shoot nukes over here, we would literally obliterate them from the face of this planet. Okay.
Yeah.
In one strike. Okay. One single strike.
Yeah.
And probably wouldn't even have to use nukes to retaliate. I mean, you know, because we're supposed to be the most powerfulest military in the whole damn universe so far, okay? So it's stupid to believe that, you know, that they could even come up with that kind of concept. Because the Russians know it back there in the Cold War. If they attack us, we're going to attack them, and the half the world is going to be a goddamn glass parking lot. I don't see a parking lot.
Astronauts living in space, Gunslinger, with Russians in the space station together. So
you think they're going to jeopardize all that shit? I don't think so. No.
If one of these little
countries out there, like Iran or some of them little cocksucking bastards over there, if they decide to be stupid, or Rocket Boy over there in North Korea, if he decides to be stupid, we'll wipe his ass completely off the face of this planet. And they know it.
I hope so, too.
Okay.
I hope so,
they
too.
Know
but,
it.
But Iranian, they 90% even maybe die. That's okay. But the 10% will rebuild Iran. And you know Cyrus the Great. Cyrus the Great, when his name came in the Bible, by the way. You know, Cyrus the Great went in an old rock they called Constantinople, okay? Over there, freed the Jews and give them money and told them, hey, you don't need to be a slave again. Go build your houses even higher and higher and big, so nobody can come and take you again in this matter, slave you. So, and the name of Iran has come 248 times in Bible. If you read your Bibles, Persia, and referring Iran today. And so, you know, the bottom line, Iran is going to play a big part in World War III. I mean, not the people of Iran. I mean, the Ayatollahs. Again, I know it's sometimes for me it's very hard to say Ayatollahs more, but sometimes I say Iran because it's easier for everybody to understand. But Iran will change. World War III will start from Ayatollahs. It says in the Bible.
I doubt that. Go ahead, Gunslinger.
The only way that we would wipe out the Ayatollahs, okay, is that you're going to have to organize the Iranian population in this country to pull off a massive terror attack and be ordered to do so by the Ayatollahs. At that point,
no.
At that point, the Ayatollahs will go away.
No. What you're saying is a joke, my friend. What I accept it as a joke. But remember,
I'm not saying a joke. But you keep wanting us to go over there and eliminate the Ayatollahs. Well, that ain't going to happen. Until the Ayatollahs punch us in the nose, then they will go away.
Okay?
Okay. But 95% of Americans who live in United States and Canada, and they escaped from the wrath of Ayatollah. So they had the services.
What did you just say? Mike, what did you just say? 95% of people in America escaped from the Ayatollah?
No. 95% of Iranians who live in United States and Canada, all of them are escaped from Ayatollah. Means don't like the Ayatollahs. So they love the, they have given so many. I mean, they're in police, they're in FBI, they're in White House, they're in many, many different parts of the United States. They're doctors, they're engineers, they're working in NASA, and et cetera. So please, I take that, what you said, as a joke completely. But 95% we love the United States of America, and we hate Ayatollahs. And so what you say, I just say, okay, you said it as whatever you want to say, but it's to me and to many Iranians who are listening right now, is a joke. Go ahead, sir.
Well, all I'm saying is the Ayatollahs have to strike first. When they do, they will go away. That's not a problem. But they have to make the first strike.
Okay, how many times, I mean, the Iranian proxies, they attack the American, right now, Red Sea, Yemen. Yemen is Iranian proxy, my friends. Okay, and they're close pretty much to the Red Sea. I mean, there's nothing much really can come and go. I know even they attack the American ships, my friend, and American ships, of course, they intercepted the missile crews from Iran, which they given to the Yemenis. You see, everywhere you go is a fingerprint of Ayatollahs everywhere. As a terrorism, Ayatollahs are cancer of Middle East, and they have to be removed. But again, Iranian people, all of them are united to take care of these bastards, but unfortunately, whatever you see they can do, as much as they can't remove this. And many of them, I mean, you know that Ayatollah Khomeini and Khamenei, which is in charge right now, they trained in Gaza. Do you know that? I mean, what happened to Israel in October 7, my friends? It was the fingerprint of Iran on it. How much more file do you want me to talk about it? That is a fingerprint. In Argentina, what happens to the to that synagogue in Argentina, you know? And it's fingerprint of Iran. I mean, everywhere you go, it's fingerprint of Iran. It's everywhere. And this terrorist regime of Iran must be removed ASAP for the sake of the humanity. Otherwise, this Ayatollah's on charge, then we will see not only World War III, then World War IV, and et cetera, too.
No, God.
Iran is going to be responsible for all the wars, huh?
Ayatollah, not Iran. Iran is
the Ayatollahs.
Terrible. Thank you very much.
I don't think so.
Yes.
I don't think we're worried about the Ayatollahs.
Israel knows that. That's why Israel is going to attack Lebanon any moment. They got received 3,000 tanks from United States. 3,000 tanks from United States to Israel right now. So Israel is ready to invade Lebanon and take care of the Hezbollah. And then after that is Ayatollah, for sure.
3,000 tanks the United States gave? You said that,
yes.
Israel? 3,000 tanks?
Yes.
When?
Yes, sir. When?
When?
You put it, you get the intel. We give you the intel. We verify it. And then you guys, go ahead and verify it for yourself. Anything I say, go ahead and verify it.
We did not give 3,000 tanks. When did we give 3,000 tanks to Israel? When? What year?
Just 4 or 5 days ago, my friend. 4 or 5 days ago.
Four or five days ago.
Yeah. you're gonna have to, Mike. I'm sorry, but you're gonna have to show me some verifiable proof that that happened.
Okay. Go to YouTube it. Go to Patrick. Go Patrick Humphrey, and go to NYC Prepper. Also YouTube it, and go to Canadian Prepper. Canadian Prepper. These three are one of the, there are three different sources of very good news, but our sources are not only from them. Our sources are from many, many other TV stations in different languages. So you know that. It's also Jerusalem Post. Jerusalem
Mike,
Post.
Mike, did you fall down today and hit your head?
I heard it on the internet, so it's got to be true.
Okay. So
3,000 tanks. We give Israel 3,000.
Hey, let me say this, Mike. Israel builds pretty damn good fucking tanks themselves. They're as good, if not. And hey, listen.
No. But
those Israeli tanks are as good.
Mike, listen to me.
Those Israeli tanks are as good or better than the Abrams A1 tank that we have for the conditions that they are fighting in.
Right.
Why would Israel want our tank?
Well, they need more ammunition. They need more equipment in order to have a successful attack and finish the Hezbollah.
Let's see, a tank crew for an Abrams A1 is 1, 2, 3, 4 people for each tank. If we gave them 3,000 times 4, where are they going to come up with the tank crews to man those tanks?
Well, you know, every Israeli, you know, that compulsory to go to military. So every Israeli know how to use tanks or jet, F-35s, F-16, etc. Every Israelis are trained fully in 2 years to use
every Israeli is trained fully as an infantryman. Not every Israeli person is trained fully to fly jets or man tanks
or any other special gear. I mean, we have seen Israel has the greatest army on the nation right now. You know that. Greatest army, greatest intel, greatest people in the world. And you know, but right now, Palestinian, they took Jewish people hostage for over 173 days right now, or for 174 days to be exact. So, you know, they need to release them. They need to understand that, you know, this is their Ramadan time. So Ramadan should be peaceful, etc. They need to release them. But they're not Muslims. You know, like Ayatollahs are not Muslims. Ayatollahs are a bunch of Arabs. They attack Iran, and they took over by the help of British Empire and other countries. And what has happened, you know, why Air France? Can you go with the Air France free from Los Angeles to, what you call it, to Paris? No. But they give Ayatollah free ticket to Iran, to Tehran. Why? These are the questions American people need to ask. Okay, how is this?
They are using them as human shields, just like they're using the Palestinian population in Gaza as human shields, which means they are hiding behind the population And Israel has to go through the population to get to them. They're a bunch of cowards.
Who are a bunch of cowards?
Hamas.
Okay, Hamas are a bunch of cowards. Okay, we are agree on that. No problem. We are in the same page. So, basically, you know, they are the ones who did the bad things to Israel. Israel was having their pouring and, I mean, there's, you know.
I don't understand how this leader of Hamas is, like, going around giving press conferences and everything, and, like, he's traveling around to other countries, leader of Hamas. I mean, how does that work exactly, you know? I mean, I think that's a crock of baloney. I mean, there's a bunch of boogeymen over there that are a bunch of nobodies, you know? I mean, where's this army of Hamas in the Gaza? I mean, you know, the Gaza's only, what, 17 miles, if that? If less than 20 miles, square miles. I mean, Israel. I mean, I just think it's all a big freaking funny show over there. I mean, what the hell's going on? I mean, you know, it's a little ridiculous. Yeah.
Do you know that each fucking Palestinian they get over $300 UBI from Israel, UBI universal basic income from them. I mean, and it's still they're fucking poor. It's still they're, living like it's 1,500 years back. You know, come on. You know, it's not the fault of Israel if they're poor. I mean, Israel has helped Palestinians so much. I mean, we know that, matter of fact. I don't know if you saw it.
I mean, how was Hamas launching rocket attacks yesterday on Israel? How are they doing this? I mean, I just don't get it.
Because underground cities, it's like the same thing that
underground cities.
Yes, they have underground cities. And that's why Israel is trying to destroy. If they found it, I mean, many times they did.
How the hell they build those cities? How'd they build them? I mean, I mean that's some freaking, you know. I mean, I don't know if they're cities. I think they're tunnels. You know,
France. You know, if United States can make, if Canada makes their own
equipment, Mike, what equipment? You got to have equipment to do all that. I mean, where'd they get the equipment? They don't have any factories in Gaza. They don't build anything over there. You know, I mean, what's going on? I just don't think, something's just not right with this whole picture, if you ask me.
What?
I just think,
right,
you know.
Everybody has understood.
I just think it's all phony.
Mean,
I think it's all fake.
I
think it's all a puppet show. I think it's all fake.
Are you
I just don't think it
that,
exists.
You know, Denver Airport beneath it is underground city. Do you deny that? Or do you accept that?
That's America. That's America, though.
Okay.
We could build underground. We're the most sophisticated country in the world. We've been around for hundreds of years. Gaza's only been around for 30 years.
Oh, Gaza is not for 30 years, my friend. It's more than that. Gaza has been there. But it's been there for more wars and more wars.
1948. Okay. The Palestine, they came up with the two-state solution or whatever. I think in the late...
Right.
Early 60s, maybe.
Right.
You know, so that hadn't been around that long.
Right. Okay, 48. So 50 years here. And so it's about 75 years. So 75 years. I mean, so there is enough time to make those tunnels and underground cities.
But Israel's been attacking them now for how long? I mean, I'm talking about bombing them, and they got ground troops. I mean, Hitler marched across Europe in 30 days. Well, how long did it take the Israeli army to go across Gaza?
Okay, Israeli is sick and tired. You know, come on. If you keep, they keep, say, Mexico or Chinese troops from the Mexico side, they keep attacking the United States. I mean, there will be war, so many years until eliminated.
What are you talking about, Mike? China talking? What are you talking about? What are you talking about, China attacking
right
the United States?
These troops are in Mexico right now, my friend. Don't you believe that?
No, they're not. They were in Canada a couple of years ago. I remember they had hundreds of thousands of troops on Canada on the border. They were getting ready to come across the border. I remember that one, too.
Okay, so you don't believe the Chinese troops are coming
we don't have Chinese troops in Mexico.
How did they get there?
I mean, the Chinese troops.
How many troops are in Mexico? That they came and they talked to them, they said, we are from China. Okay, I mean, it doesn't make sense that Chinese
like the pilgrims, right?
come from Mexico and come to the United States. I mean, they have
they
money.
Landed.
I mean,
they landed on Plymouth Rock in Mexico. they said, hey, hi, I'm from China. Hey, how are you? And the Mexico say, arriba, what you? Ain't
okay.
No Chinese.
So you don't believe on that? You don't believe
no.
on that?
No, okay.
You don't believe. That's why.
So you're telling me Chinese troops landed in Mexico, and what did they do when they got there? They said, "How you doing?" We're telling you. So I don't get. Well, I just don't get how they get there.
I mean, when I said the troops that are not like dressed like Chinese troops, they are just civilians. They come this side of borderline, and then they disappear, they go to wherever they're supposed to go. And then later on, they're going to give shock and awe to us. That's the problem. That's what I'm saying. I mean, when I said Chinese
How are they
going to
do that now? How are they going to do that? How are they going to get the weapons and stuff? How are they going to get all these weapons and to do shock and awe?
Well, I mean...
In the Biden administration...
Well, maybe you're right there. Yeah.
I mean, they if they send them, I'm sure they already sent everything that they need to do. For example, you know,
you can't smuggle weapons. You can't. You know how hard it is to smuggle stuff into this country. Unless the government's doing it themselves. For me to go smuggle something without any government help, it'd be very difficult. Very difficult. Trust me.
Right now, we give 3,000 Haitian every month refugee, my friend. They come as soon as
they're monitored, traced, tracked. Trust me. Anything that's sold like that, anything that makes it. I mean, yes, you can. It can be done. It can be done, but not on a sophisticated level like you're talking about. With China's doing it. You know, they're bringing weapons into the country. No.
You put the word in my mouth, my friend. You said that. I didn't say it.
You could have mentioned Arkansas.
No. You know, I said that. You know, they have. I mean, Long Beach belongs to China. Are you saying yes or no?
What belongs to China?
Long Beach belongs to Long Beach Port.
China owns Long Beach, you're saying?
I said China owns Long Beach Port. Yes or no?
No.
Yes.
Okay.
They own Long Beach Port. Yes. They own the port of Long Beach, you're saying?
Yes, absolutely.
How do you guys get this information? Where are you getting this from?
Okay, they bought it.
Please explain it to him, my friend.
They bought it.
The other friend. Oh, bravo. Bravo. Thank you very much.
They bought it?
All right, let's see.
I know everybody keeps saying they're buying up land, and I'm not seeing it. They're saying no. Everyone's saying no. They don't. As a matter of fact, there's laws in a lot of states now where they can't. Reports. In America, owned by China. Hang on.
You see, this my friend, the other my friend said he understood what I'm saying. So I hope you explain it more to my friend, Joel. So
well,
he can
I just
understand.
Don't think this is, I just think it's weird. China owns 380,000 acres of land in the United States. All right. As of 2021, China ranked 18 out of 111 total countries that owned the most farmland in the United States. Number one is Canada. Number two is the Netherlands. Number three is Italy. Number four is the United Kingdom. Number five is Germany. China's 18. So China's ranked 18th in land ownership right now. So they're not even number one. Canada's number one. You know, they're not even ranked in the top 10, guys. So I can't see China being that much of a threat.
Who operates the Long Beach port If somebody can hear
not,
me.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
It's not how much property they own. It is where is that property located that they own.
We call it farmland. Well, they say farmland.
Yeah. Yes. And where is that where is that farmland located?
I don't know. Probably all different spots, I would say.
Near
I don't know. I'll find out, though. Long Beach, California. I want to find out about California.
Okay, put it on the thing. The exact wording.
I'm on a military website. So I'm typing. It's got a certain. Never mind. Long Beach, California.
And all my friends, be reasonable. You know, we don't talk just off my stomach. We research. We are journalists like yourself.
Yeah,
we are journalists
like
other friends that are in here.
U.S. forces China out of port of Long Beach terminal. Said who owns the Long Beach container terminal? Owns the Long Beach container. It's a container terminal. That's what they own. They own a container terminal. They own one. Okay, so they own a terminal off of Long Beach. That's what it is. Nothing wrong with that.
But I said the same thing.
All of our products, guys, from them, from China. Of course they're going to have ports and terminals in America. Of course they will. You know, they ship all their crap over here.
So the question is, when they say we don't want to do anything, we don't want to deliver anything, then all the equipment belongs to China. So it's remotely, they can, you know, control it. So suppose we want to bring the goods, and suddenly they remotely, they say no. Don't pick up that container. So you see they're going to put a hell on us? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, they're dumping the they're emptying, they're dumping the freaking shipping containers, too, once they're done offloading them in neighborhoods in the United States.
But it's all they control it, my friend. When they control everything, they can say,
we can kick them out. Listen, if there's ever a declaration of war, guess what? All those ports get seized and all the material in them. And then that, and no shipping comes in. So if there's ever a declaration of war, so really China, we have ports over in China too, you know, the stuff that
we
export.
I don't think.
No,
so.
We don't.
We don't have no ports in China.
No,
that's true.
Hang on.
We don't.
There is no port owned by a United States corporation or company. In
absolutely.
China.
Yeah, but all
there
of
is
our
nothing,
corporations and companies are
there is
nothing
in China that is owned by a foreign nation.
That's right.
Really?
That's right. That's right.
Well, that's because they're communists. Right. They're communists. Why? I'm still going to check, though. We own Taiwan. That's why. That's why they want us out of Taiwan, then.
Okay. We own Taiwan. Okay, yes, that's true.
Pretty much, yeah. So we don't need any. State-owned Chinese companies own stakes by U.S. ports. Yeah.
Joe, one other thing you need to look up, okay? Look up Club K containers.
What's to say that again?
Club K's.
Club K?
Club K's.
Club K's.
And what are they?
Hang on. Containers.
So is this my friend that has a car problem? Did you get your car back yet or not?
It's a missile system.
It's a what?
Missile system.
A mental system?
Missile system.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes. Club K's are a missile system.
Yep.
Guess what Club K's fit into?
I'm looking at them right now. Shipping containers.
That's right. That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Guess what, Joe?